Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
University of Texas historian Dinah Ramey Barry has spent the last decade studying the economic forces that have defined black and white relations in the United States. Her book, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation, is out today. Professor Barry joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
What in this part of American history has really not been told and that you're bringing to light for the first time, and how does it inform what's going on today in America, do you think?
The first is that most people don't realize that enslaved people were sold before they were born. They were also sold after they died. And I think that's a piece of this story that has not really been talked about that much in very many history books. And to understand that valuation occurred before, you know, anticipating women's fertility, anticipating the health of their unborn children, and accounting for that in the records. And then also this sort of illegal clandestine market of cadavers that were sold to medical schools for anatomical research.
When you think about all of those features and the value of the unborn, how would a woman be evaluated in her fertility? I mean, would it literally be said, well, she'll probably have this many kids? Was it known who she would have children with, those kinds of things?
Yeah, sometimes planters deliberately forced or selected particular people to partner up. And I look at this as a form of non-consensual intercourse. But they might have handpicked someone who was a strong worker, who had physical capabilities that maybe other enslaved people didn't express. And they would force those two to be together. They also would look at women to see if they had already had children, if those children were doing well, if they were working well. And if a woman had given birth to a number of children and they survived to age 5, they would kind of look at her as someone that they could look to as a breeding woman. And then that term, in that day, they would use the term breeding wench.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, February 10th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our third study session on the late Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro. We're picking up at the beginning of chapter 2, the audio segment you heard at the beginning. That was author Dana Ramey Barry, a black female author. She just wrote the book, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh. One of the critical points of the book is the consumption, as you heard, of black cadavers, black bodies after the person had transitioned. Extensive trade. We talked about this for people who were with us last year when we read Medical Apartheid, Harriet A. Washington, one of my top 5 favorite books. She has a whole chapter dealing with this, and not just presenting this as something that white people used to do, that this is an ongoing practice in terms of trafficking in black bodies, black corpses, body parts, the whole nine. extensive, just not frequently publicly discussed aspect of white culture. But I heard that this book just came out within the last couple weeks. I'm looking forward to reading it. But when I heard that interview a couple weeks ago, I immediately thought, I think we had just started The Delectable Negro, or were about to start it. Thought, bing, that is exactly what Mr. Woodard is talking about. We will go ahead and get started. Context of White Supremacy. Again, this is the late Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one.
Sex, honor, and human consumption. Lilburn Lewis, a Kentucky slave owner, owned a considerable number of slaves whom he drove constantly, hit sparingly, and lashed severely. According to abolitionist Lydia Maria Child, Lewis was a typical plantation owner whom most in the local community probably respected and looked to as a model wealthy citizen in terms of his treatment of his slaves. In 1826, he would commit crimes against his slaves that would cause his community to ostracize him and pursue legal restraint. He committed suicide while awaiting criminal trial. It is hard to say from the evidence if George, a young recalcitrant slave on Lewis's plantation, was a favorite or if Lewis consciously chose him, as many masters did, as the object of ritualized violence and as an emblem of his manhood and noble social stature. As we know for sure is that George, like many on the plantation, often went hungry, suffered the lash too often, and grew to despise and resist this condition of bondage. George provoked his master's penchant for punishment by frequently running away in addition to disobeying. Sent to the spring one day to collect water into an elegant pitcher, George made the horrid mistake of letting the pitcher fall and standing by and watching it as it dashed to shivers on the rocks. As punishment for George's transgression, his master bound him to a wooden plank and, in the manner of a butcher, quartered him with an axe and cooked his severed body parts and pieces of flesh over a billowing fire. In preparation for this ritualized punishment, Lewis gathered all of the slaves on the plantation into the most roomy Negro house, bolted the door, and told those assembled that the design of this meeting was to teach them to remain at home and obey his orders. The ritual begins with George's younger brother helping the master bind the slave to a wooden bench. George was called up, and by the assistance of his younger brother, laid on a broad bench or block. The master then cut off his ankles with a broad axe. In vain, the unhappy victim screamed. Not a hand among so many dared to interfere. Having cast the feet into the fire, he, the master, lectured the Negroes at some length. He then proceeded to cut off his limbs below the knees. The sufferer besought him to begin with his head. It was in vain. The master went on thus until trunk, arm, and head were all in the fire. Still protracting the intervals with lectures and threatenings of light punishment, in case any of them were disobedient or ran away, or disclose the tragedy that they were compelled to witness. In order to consume the bones, the fire was briskly stirred until midnight. Sometimes in the early morning, an earthquake materialized and shook the slave shack, crumbling the walls and extinguishing the fire. This act brought an abrupt halt to the master's activities, and the Negroes were allowed to disperse, with charges to keep the secret, under the penalty of light punishment. Later that evening, Lewis's wife inquires into her husband's activities. When his wife asked the cause of the dreadful scream she had heard, he said that he had never enjoyed himself so well at a ball as he had enjoyed himself that evening. Lewis's response to his wife, as disturbing and incongruous as it is, puts this entire scenario into context. Contrasted against the plantation mistress and the domestic sphere, we see more clearly George's erotic significance to his master and the clandestine pleasure-taking that the white man associates with his slave. The metaphor of the ball is significant insofar as one goes to a ball with someone. Lewis would, under normal circumstances, attend a ball with his wife, dancing with her, holding her close, smelling and touching her body. Instead, we have George as the unwilling feminized partner and conjugal mate. It is George whom the master touches, smells, violently lavishes with attention and care, and ingests with the same relish that he would hors d'oeuvre, fine music, or cocktails served in an open bar at a ball. George and his ritualized punishment reify and ennoble Lewis's white male identity. Powerful feelings of satiation, leisurely comfort, and pleasure accompany Lewis's cannibalization of George. As parasite and consumer, the master takes in, imbibes George's essence, George's terror, and the terror of all the slaves feed the master's authority and power. And we have to consider that in addition to emotional and spiritual consumption, the master might have literally ingested pieces of George's flesh. Literal consumption was such a taboo topic during the time period that even radical abolitionists such as Child evaded direct discussion of the topic. When Child presented the facts of Lewis's case in an appeal in favor of that class of Americans called Africans, she made no comment about the literal implications of Lewis's flesh quartering and cooking ritual, or about the significance of the secrecy that he continually reinforces through speech and act. This lack of comment from a woman who frequently noted the most extreme and disturbing implications of the slave master's cruelties indicates how taboo was the subject of human consumption. Understanding Child's tentativeness concerning the topic of human consumption gives us all the more reason to wonder about the literal implications of Lewis's cannibalistic ritual and the truth of what he really sought to hide through his constant reinforcing of silence and secrecy. I begin this chapter with this graphic example of symbolic, if not literal, human consumption because it illustrates how there existed during slavery unspoken codes of white male honor and respectability connected to the consumption of the slave. Master Lewis reinforces the secrecy and clandestine nature of his actions by bolting the door of the slave cabin, threatening like punishment to those who disclosed the tragedy they were compelled to witness, and excavating and secretly reburying George's bones after the earthquake has leveled the building. Furthermore, his invocation of ball culture in his report to his wife clues us in to how he associated social esteem and finery with the cannibalization of George. A heinous and unspeakable bond of clandestine honor and pleasure-taking binds Lewis to his slaves. As we see through events on the Lewis plantation, the most intimate sharers of the unknown secret were, in most cases, the slaves and the slave master, and the most reliable and enlightened witnesses were the slaves themselves. In slave narratives and ex-slave interviews, black persons correlated white consumptive appetites with southern codes of honor and nobility. Whites rarely acknowledged the comments made by blacks. At the same time, these repressed black voices provide invaluable insights into debates about cannibalism in the 19th century United States, the erotic and homoerotic implications of the consumption of slaves, and the unspoken codes of sex and honor that inform black male consumption. Orlando Patterson writes that the master's sense of honor was derived directly from the degradation of his slave, beginning in childhood and continuing through life in his despotic exercise of power. Elsewhere, Patterson emphasizes that the master generally camouflaged this association of honor with the master's relationship to the slave so as not to reveal his dependence, his parasitism of the slave. John Hope Franklin posits honor as the most central defining characteristic of 19th century Southerner culture, the honor of the Southerner, Franklin proclaims, caused him to defend with his life the slightest suggestion of irregularity in his honesty or integrity, and he was fiercely sensitive to any imputation that might cast a shadow on the character of the woman of his family. To him, nothing was more important than honor. Indeed, he placed it above wealth, art, learning, and the other delicacies of urban civilization, and regarded its protection as a continuing preoccupation. Franklin describes a public culture of honor wherein chivalry, how one was regarded in society, upper class status, courtship practices, and rituals of social etiquette all played a role in the performance of and the display of male honor. However, when it came to the topic of consumption under slavery, these public rules and displays of honor took a clandestine, unspoken cast. Proponents of Southern slave culture did their best to repress evidence of the slave master who would rather whip a Negro than sit down to the best dinner. Such persons reveal the existence of an acquired taste for and a premium placed on Negro flesh that went against myths that blacks were tainted, disgusting, and untouchable. The example of the Kentucky slave owner Lewis exemplifies notions of etiquette, good taste, homoeroticism, and gender variance in shaping white masculinity on the plantation. Yet the slave-owning community to which Lewis belongs and Lewis himself both conspire to hide and contain, through legal reprimand and suicide, the reality of the master's feeding upon slave and ennobling self and society in the process. Numerous documented scenarios of this type confirm that plantation masters maintained, in large part, a clandestine culture of honor and sex based in the social consumption of the slave. Still, as prevalent as such examples are, the dominant narrative on and off the plantation continues to be that the consumption of slaves brought dishonor to self and community. Going against this common assumption, I strive throughout this chapter to decipher the implicit social codes that, as Patterson observes, translated the slave's degradation into the master's despotic honor, and more specifically, into consumptive appetites that reified and ennobled white masculinity on and off of the plantation. Before we can understand and analyze this unspoken culture of honor associated with slave consumption, it helps to first understand how thoroughly a rhetoric of dishonor infused discussions of slave consumption in 19th century America. Following this line of inquiry, I begin the discussion of consumption and dishonor by examining the prevalent 19th century concern that the United States was becoming a cannibal nation. Clergy, congressmen, popular novelists, and northern abolitionists, among others, passionately debated the topic of the United States becoming a cannibal nation as a result of its condoning and legally sanctioning slavery. Implicitly, those who engage in this discussion presume that cannibal nationhood was a dishonorable thing, concerned with returning to the nation a sense of honorable and noble purpose. Discussions among white Americans rarely focus on the particular codes of honor within cultures of consumption on the plantation. Neither did such discussions focus on the social consumption of the Negro within the nation at large, a reality that fugitive and emancipated black persons consistently emphasize in their writings and speeches. This national discussion of black male consumption and honor frames my ensuing discussion of literal instances of human consumption. In the 18th and 19th centuries, a number of different instances of cannibalism at sea, cannibalism that took place following shipwrecks, occurred involving black men. Although cannibalism at sea was common in the 18th and 19th centuries, reported cases focusing on the consumption of black males were not. Cases that involve black men, like the above-mentioned Essex affair and incidents associated with the Peggy and the French Tiger, still today evoke strong feelings of shame and dishonor among American whites and Europeans. These cases also illuminate how the choice made by whites to eat black men aboard ships coincided with ideologies of Negro inferiority and the logic and practice of chattel bondage in the plantation South and other regions of the United States. By the 19th century, consumptive ideologies and practices on slave plantations had come to have a far-reaching influence, affecting even the consumption of blacks at sea. With such cases, it is not just a matter of survival of the fittest at sea. Rather, in these examples of consumption of black men, we see the culture and ideology of slavery strongly influencing the choice of whites to murder and eat black men. On the whole, American citizens regarded the consumption of black men at sea as dishonorable. I argue, however, that there existed in such acts an implicit code of honor that spanned from southern plantations to northern abolitionist communities. To support my discussion of survival cannibalism, I also examined numerous other examples of the ritualistic quartering, seasoning, boiling, and cooking of blacks that bestowed honor and social stature upon white men. In the final section of this chapter, I examine the correlation among sex, honor, and human consumption. Throughout this chapter, as demonstrated through the Lewis Plantation example, I presume an implicit interconnection among sex, honor, and human consumption. I make clear, though, in this last section of this chapter, how thoroughly homoerotic and homosexual desire shape the master-slave relation and inform white male codes of honor. Erotic desire for the slave, as I argued in the previous chapter, frequently overlaps with consumptive practices and appetites. In the realm of the erotic, we get a closer picture of the intimate ties between master and slave. White strove to conceal and hide this domain of intimacy, as it fundamentally contradicted the ideologies and brutal practices designed to reinforce the inhumanity of the enslaved and free black person. Drawing on the narrated experiences of ex-slaves who graphically depict the hungers, tastes, and erotic desires of white men for black men, I demonstrate that the literal and metaphoric ingestion of black persons often coincided with white male sexual appetite, titillation, and erotic play. The scenarios I examine reveal, at the basis level of social interaction, how sex facilitates the honorific social status of white men and their domination over the enslaved person. I close this section and the chapter with an examination of the Nat Turner insurrection. Following his execution, whites boiled Turner's flesh down to a liquid and allegedly ingested it as a medicinal substance. The erotics of taste, sexualized violence, and white male codes of honor coalesced in this incident, bringing into plainer view this hidden culture of the appetite and hunger of white men. Cannibal Nation. The social consumption of the enslaved person was such a concern in the colonial United States that senators, religious leaders, and abolitionists heatedly debated whether colonial America was becoming something akin to a cannibal nation. Among 19th century abolitionists and other conscientious persons, the central issue was not the liberation and unburdening of the African soul, but the moral implications for whites who were fast developing what many literally refer to as a cannibalistic hunger for black flesh. In the public domain, where this debate took place, whites regarded human consumption as a dishonorable act. Shame, national degradation, and widespread anxiety shaped the national debate, leaving no room for consideration of the secret codes of honor that white men maintained quietly among themselves. Feelings of shame and national dishonor motivated Horace Mann to address the House of Representatives on February the 23rd, 1849. The oration was published later as Slavery and the Slave Trade in the District of Columbia. Speaking before his peers, Mann spoke of slavery as contagion, a rampant virus that wounds our mortal and religious sensibilities. He offers an allegorical example of a clean, unpolluted northern statesman traveling to the District of Columbia in observing how slavery has tainted and corrupted white citizens. In his allegory, he calls specific attention to the glorified purpose of white Americans as the race of men whom God endowed with the faculties of intelligence. He describes the white American man as despoiled of the power of improving those faculties as a result of institutionalized slavery, and makes reference to a dynamic of honor and shame impacting the lives of northern white citizens who condoned slavery in the recapture of fugitive persons. It was difficult enough to convince whites at the time that the brutal treatment of the African person also had an effect on the African person's heart, emotions, and soul. Never mind trying, as man does, to bring the nation's and white statesmen's attention to the subtle motive and spirit undergirding the relationship between master and slave. Missing the allegorical point, a Mr. Broadhead responds to man, "Would you advance a slave to an equal social and political condition with the white race?" A bit exasperated, man moves from this example of a white statesman to examples from English history, a discussion of race and skin color, biblical mythology, and additional legal statutes as a means of generating self-reflection in his audience. Finally, feeling that his point still had not been adequately conveyed, man asserts what he had perhaps all along meant to say, that U.S. slavery was a form of social cannibalism and that whites were becoming, unbeknown to themselves, the very cannibalistic types that they feared and projected upon every strange land and people they encountered. It is as though a man should migrate from one of those South Sea islands where cannibalism is legalized and where the public authorities, according to reports of travelers, not only condemn and execute a criminal, but dine on him after he is executed. Mann also references cannibalism law in his sense of a cannibalized jurisdiction that helps sustain this culture he describes. Not only does Mann accuse slave owners of practicing a type of symbolic and perhaps literal cannibalism, he also implicates northern states who, according to the practice of returning fugitive slaves to the masters, forego cannibalism rights, but are nonetheless implicated in the appetite and principles of human consumption practiced in southern states. In other domains of society, American citizens attempted to describe this appetite for human consumption that was cultivated in the context of slavery. The following year, 1850, a concerned citizen published an editorial response to a letter defending slave catching written by Daniel Webster in the widely distributed paper The National Era. The editorial applied the topics of slavery and fugitive law to the North. In particular, J.G.W., the author of the editorial, wanted the reader to understand the elusive moral implications of something he describes as Christian cannibalism. The editorial begins, "We are more pained than surprised, therefore, to find the great Massachusetts Senator, Daniel Webster, taking another step downward. He has published a very appropriate and, we doubt not, very satisfactory argument in support of the legal, moral, and religious obligation of slave catching on the part of law-abiding citizens and Bible-loving Christians of the free states. It is a literary monstrosity which will make the fortune of the antiquarian who shall hereafter bring it to light, when Christian slaveholding shall have become as difficult of comprehension as Christian cannibalism." Many Christian slave-owning whites thought of themselves as rescuing Africans from a heathen land. Heathenism included, among other things, sexual licentiousness, incest, polygamy, and cannibalism. The idea of a Christian slaveholding cannibal or a northern thoroughly Christian cannibal type was, as J.G.W. points out, inconceivable. It was a literary monstrosity that twisted the religious theologies, legal tenets, and rhetorical logic underlying church and state into monstrous forms. These looming monsters terrified many northern whites. In the Honorable Mr. Giddings, a member of Congress, this terror took the form of political anxiety in an outright declaration of white slave owners as cannibals. All we can do, explains the Honorable Giddings, is see that they, Southerners, shall not disgrace nor degrade this government, either by their slavery or their cannibalism. Our motto is, keep your slavery, your disgusting barbarity, within your own states. Bring it not unto this hall, nor attempt to involve us in its burdens or its crimes. Giddings imagines Southern cannibalistic appetites as tainting the Constitution of the North and spreading like a contagion into the moral core and implementation of the law. George Fitzhugh, a political philosopher, Southerner, and slave owner, expanded the geography of the debate about cannibalism to include the North. In 1857, in Cannibals All, or Slaves Without Masters, Fitzhugh rehearses the typical narratives of Africans as heathen and slavery as a civilizing force in the African's life. He then makes broader, more revealing arguments about the cannibalistic temptations inherent in the chattel slave system. Linking cannibalism to labor production, he writes, to treat free laborers badly and unfairly is universally inculcated as a moral duty, and the selfishness of man's nature prompts him to the most rigorous performance of this cannibalish duty. The South, according to Fitzhugh, has risen above these temptations. Southern slave owners love, care for, and presumably want the best for their slaves. It is Northerners, assess Fitzhugh, who are in danger of becoming cannibals. It is Northerners who advocate a laissez-faire economics and ultimately unequal, unfair consumption of the labor of the disenfranchised working class. Where Southern slave owners love Negroes, Fitzhugh sees Northerners as having the aversion to Negroes. In implicating the North in a capital-based system of human consumption, Fitzhugh hearkens back to ancient European legacies and traditions of human consumption that prefigure mercantilism and U.S. chattel slavery. These cannibalistic practices were, as Fitzhugh asserts, sometimes connected to aristocratic abuse and the profiteering interests of the business class. They figure in ancestral rites, religious practices, and burial rites. Edward Gibbon, relying on the authority of St. Jerome, reported that the Scots and Picts of pre-Christian England formerly delighted in the taste of human flesh, so that they attacked the shepherd rather than his flock for their horrid repast. Romans accused Christians of consuming human blood in their rituals, a contested accusation that is still debated among contemporary scholars. A 15th century German print depicts the murder of Simon of Trent, with Jewish rabbis assembled around his body, harvesting his blood for consumptive purposes. There was a largely unremarked upon strand of medical cannibalism practiced in Victorian and Renaissance Europe. This type of cannibalism involved mummifying the bodies of criminals and other persons so that the parts could later be ingested for medicinal purposes. Europeans brought this tradition to early colonial America, and in the 18th and 19th centuries, there were those who still maintained the practice. According to W. Ahrens, the foregoing of such legacies and the blanket consigning of human cannibalism to faraway lands and peoples has informed the mission of European global expansionism and occupation of other land in essential ways. Much to our satisfaction, the discussion of cannibalism as a custom is normally restricted to a faraway land just prior to or during their pacification by the various agents of Western civilization. explorer, conquistador, missionary, trader, and colonizer all play their roles in the civilizing mission. Correspondingly, if the time is lengthened sufficiently back to the pre-Christian era, we permit ourselves a glimpse of this sort of savagery among our own forebears. Arns finds it noteworthy that as Christian-influenced European groups encountered foreigners in other lands, they consistently mediated this contact with myths and assertions of cannibalism. Accusations of cannibalism have served as a handy tool in the arsenal of conquest. Furthermore, the creation of Africans and Native Americans as cannibals has allowed European Americans to refashion themselves as anything but cannibalistic, erasing in the process their European legacies of cannibalism and their newly developed appetites and hungers for flesh in the New World. On this latter point, Arndt says, cannibalism becomes the feature of the faraway or the foregone, which is much the same thing. In the way that the dimensions of time and space are interpreted, they, in the form of distant cannibals, are reflections of us as we once were. This dichotomy of them and us is a crucial point of distinction that helps explain why the notion of white civilized cannibals brought to the mind and heart such strong feelings of dishonor, shame, and disgrace in 19th century America. In a European colonialist mode of thinking, the presence of cannibalistic others marked a philosophical boundary, a threshold of human versus non-human experience. It helped Europeans and white Americans establish the rigid boundaries of the real, of the humane and inhumane, of chaos and temporal spatial order, of honorable and dishonorable social status in the process of empire and reality building. Cannibalism, according to Jeffrey Sanborn, has functioned as the ungraspable margin that limits and distorts the objective, and which is precisely the real. To accept human consumption as a social reality and norm would have been called for a fundamental rethinking of American civil identity and epistemic reality. Even more, it would have demanded of whites an acknowledgement of the deep and pervasive ways that they had come to objectify the African and black person, at the same time that they maintained intimate and acquired taste for the black person's flesh, emotional presence, and soul in the 19th century.
Eating Blacks at Sea. In the public domain and realms of debate, Northern whites mostly sought out a means to excise the dreaded Southern cannibal from the American landscape. The debate stayed in the realm of the ideological, with clergy, lawyers, congresspersons, and artists discussing the Negro's presence and his problematic social role in metaphoric terms. Ultimately, white men wanted to return to their persons and to the nation at large a sense of honor and nobility that they felt white Southern slave-owning men had degraded through their consumptive appetites and social practices. The rhetoric of slave consumption as dishonorable grew out of these Northern white desires and responses. However, I want to explore in this and later sections of this chapter the political social reality of the consumption of slaves, which, contrary to popular notions of dishonor attributed to the consumption of human beings, took shape from unspoken codes of honor and white male social stature. Within this clandestine material culture of consumption, whites maintain emotional, affectionate, romantic, erotic, and disguised intimate ties with blacks that contradicted the commonly held notion that cannibalism was unnatural to civilized Westerners. According to Henry Bolingbroke's A Voyage to the Demery, the reason Westerns consider cannibalism to be unnatural is that it seems to be a principle of our nature to be averse to devouring what has been an object of affection. Scholars within cannibalism studies frequently cite Bolingbroke's assessment of Western aversion to cannibalism as a means of ameliorating any correlation between Western advancement and human consumption. Yet the symbolic and literal consumption of black persons on and off the plantation contradicted Bolingbroke's idea, as consumptive acts often occurred in the most intimate and supposedly loving plantation context. The love that motivated whites to consume blacks aboard the ship Essex did not fall into the category of romantic love. Rather, it was a peculiar brand of fraternal love, admiration, and honorific social status that motivated white men at sea to choose blacks as their ideal objects of consumption. In the narrative of the most extraordinary and distressing shipwreck of the whale ship Essex of Nantucket, the first published account of the harrowing events that took place aboard the whaling ship, Owen Chase makes a point of emphasizing the inherent honor of ship captains, the respectable familial origins of young men such as himself, and the honor and respect that Nantucketers accorded men who worked in the whaling industry. Regarding the ship captain, he writes, "Respect is due to the character and standing of a captain of a whale ship, which those of the merchant service affect so much to undervalue. If the post of danger be the post of honor, and if merit emanates from exemplary private character, uncommon intelligence, and professional gallantry, then it is due to a great majority of the shipmasters of Nantucket." Commenting more broadly on men who work in the whaling industry, he says, "A Nantucket man is on all occasions fully sensible of the honor and merit of his profession. No doubt because he knows that his laurels, like the soldiers, are plucked from the brink of danger." Elsewhere he writes, "The profession is one of great ambition and full of honorable excitement. A tame man is never known amongst them." No one can deny the valor and the honor that Chase, the Essex ship captain, George Pollard, and other crew members, Benjamin Lawrence, Gideon Folger, and Paul Macy, among others, displayed when their ship wrecked off the shore of Henderson Island on December 20, 1838. The quick-thinking captain had the crew immediately move all the ship's provisions to three boats that had been left intact. He devised a plan for braving the sea and rationing their provisions while they searched for other whaling ships to rescue them. And even when the crew, having exhausted all of their provisions, resorted to human cannibalism, the captain still managed to maintain a semblance of order and cohesion reflective of the honor and respect accorded to him by his crew. Given the emphasis upon honor and valor in Nantucket culture, it makes sense that the Essex incident would have registered in the Nantucket community as a peculiarly shameful and dishonorable experience. As I have already noted, for America in general, the idea of cannibalism brought to mind heathen and savage cultures. By this time in American history, Europeans had either conquered, mostly eradicated, or reformed the so-called savage cultures of Native America and coastal Africa. Nantucketers felt betrayed by Chase for even mentioning the subject of cannibalism in the public domain. According to Nathaniel Philbrick, the last thing they wanted placed before the nation and the world was a detailed account of how some of their own men and boys had been reduced to cannibalism. In the early 20th century, this stigma of shame and degradation remained. When asked about the Nantucket affair, the daughter of Benjamin Lawrence, the boat steerer aboard the Nantucket, replied, "We do not mention this in Nantucket." The main reason for the silence concerning the Essex incident had to do in part with cannibalism, but more significantly with the fact that the first persons eaten from the Essex crew were African Americans. The captain's log reported that a black man in one of the boats accompanying his died on January 25th and was eaten. On January 23rd, a black man in the captain's boat died, and his body was shared for food between the crews of both boats. On January 27th, a black man died in the other boat, and on January 28th, yet another black man died in the captain's boat, both of whom were eaten. human consumption at sea was not an unusual occurrence at the time. It was unusual, though, that the first four persons eaten among a crew of black and white men were black. Also questionable were the purported natural deaths of the black men from starvation and thirst. According to Philbrick, it was also difficult for Nantucketers to explain why the first four men to be eaten had been African American. More to the point, it was difficult for Nantucketers to explain how the black men had died or the racial logic informing their murder and consumption. It did not help that Nantucket had a national reputation as a Quaker town and a hub of abolitionist activity. Thought of as a people who protected and provided sanctuary for blacks, Nantucketers had a hard time accepting that members of their own community might have considered blacks expendable and even more, consumable. Late 20th century scholars have, for the most part, evaded these dynamics of shame and dishonor that informed the black man's consumption by the Essex crew. Rather than face disparities between abolitionism and human consumption, scholars have resorted to theories of luck and natural selection, and even an invented pseudo-scientific hypothesis that implicitly preserves Nantucket codes of honor and silence. In The Cannibal Within, for example, Louis Petrovich recounts how the blacks had the bad luck to die first, completely ignoring the racial motivations informing the black man's death. Accepting and elaborating on the natural death thesis, Philbrick attributes black deaths aboard the Essex to malnutrition. He writes, "It was likely that the African Americans had suffered from an inferior diet prior to the sinking." He adds to this hypothesis a late 20th century scientific study that claims that American blacks tend to have less body fat than their Caucasian counterparts. Once a starving body exhausts itself of fat, it begins consuming muscle, a process that soon results in the deterioration of the internal organs and eventually death. In the final estimation, even Philbrick has to acknowledge the realities of racism and slavery ideology when considering the consumption of the black men. Setting aside his racially prejudiced and pseudo-scientific hypothesis, Philbrick admits, "Since there would be no black survivors to contradict the testimonies of the whites, the possibility exists that the Nantucketers took a far more active role in ensuring their own survival than has been otherwise suggested. Certainly, the statistics raise suspicion. Of the first four sailors to be eaten, all were black. Short of murdering the black crew members, the Nantucketers could have refused to share meat with them. Fortunately, we have the recorded observations of William Comstock. Comstock came closest to revealing the hidden racial reality behind the consumption of black males in the 19th century. Comstock revealed that although Nantucket stood as a stronghold of abolitionism, the community at large still maintained ideas of blacks as lacking humanity and as best suited to the roles of slaves and servants to white masters. These were some of the secret and unspoken thoughts that Nantucketers were unwilling to voice, for they revealed a world in which, contrary to popular rhetoric, the consumption and degradation of black men did in fact ennoble and reify white masculinity. According to Comstock, the fact that Nantucket was an abolitionist stronghold and a largely Quaker culture did not prevent ship captains and crews from treating blacks like beasts of burden. He writes in A Voyage to the Pacific, descriptive of the customs, usages, and sufferings on board of Nantucket whale ships, "An African is treated like a brute by the officers of the ship. Blacks were treated so badly that Comstock advised them to avoid Nantucket altogether. Should these pages fall into the hands of any of my colored brethren, let me advise them to fly Nantucket as they would have the Norway maelstrom." An 1807 visitor to Nantucket agreeing with Comstock, wrote, "The Negroes, though they are to be prized for their habits of obedience, are not as intelligent as the Indians, and none of them attain the rank of both steer and mate." These comments about the community of Nantucket reflect, within a broader cultural context, how European colonizers typically regarded noble Indian savages and brutish African types. Elsewhere in the nation, during this time period, whites used the same logic to justify slavery and the general denigration of black persons in 19th century American culture. As far as Nantucket was concerned, Nantucket ship captains had a reputation for being Negro drivers, and Nantucketers themselves referred to the vessel that delivered potential black ship hands from New York City as the Slaver. Comstock offers a different perspective on Nantucketers' feelings of shame and dishonor, helping us see how the consumption of the black man informed unspoken white male codes of honor. For the white men aboard the Essex, issues of group honor and masculine respectability inform their choice to kill and eat a black person before they would do so to one of their own. Such an act reinforced the black male's socially expendable status, his exclusion from white male honor and fraternity, his exoticization, and his brutishness, which whites linked to his supposedly inferior African ancestry. To have chosen a white man for consumption over a black man would have violated these codes of black dehumanization that implicitly inform white male honor and fraternity aboard the Essex. Given the clandestine reality of racialized consumption aboard the Essex, one cannot help but wonder how many untold instances of black consumption at sea occurred under similar circumstances. To what extent has a larger history of black consumption at sea been altered or erased by whites who sought to conceal what they thought of as their shameful appetites and hungers for black male flesh? The Essex was neither the first nor the last white crew to engage in organized, ideologically justified consumption of black persons at sea. The American ship Peggy sailed from the Azores on October 24th, 1765, bound for New York with a captain and crew of 8 men, one of whom was a Negro slave. Only 5 days into their journey, the crew of the Peggy encountered a severe and disabling thunderstorm that lasted for weeks. The crew rationed all their food and water. When all their food was gone, then they ate leather, barnacles scraped from the ship's side, tobacco, lamp oil, and candles. The starving crew faced that dreadful decision: who to eat first among their crew. It appeared that the crew drew lots, with the result that the Negro was chosen as the first person to be murdered and consumed. In actuality, the white crew had decided before they drew lots that they would kill and eat the enslaved man. According to Petrinovich, the lot had been consulted only for the sake of form, because the black was prescribed the moment the sailors first formed their resolution. Unspoken codes of superiority and group honor dictated the white crew's relationship to the slave. As a choice object of consumption, the black man reifies the bonds of fraternity, domination, and right to life shared among the white men. In the choice to kill and consume the black man, the white man reinforced the premium value of white masculinity. The dishonorable and illogical act would have been to choose a white man over a slave. Such a choice would have violated the unspoken racial contract among whites and would have gone against the logic of the slave as an expendable, consumable object. The feasting that follows reinforces this white male bond of ideology and appetite. One of the crew ate the liver raw. Some of the rest of the body was cooked, and the remainder, cut up and referred to as steaks, was pickled and with the head and fingers thrown overboard. Curiously, in the Peggy incident, whites employ rituals of democracy and fairness to disguise for themselves and the slave the real nature of the social contract. The white men cast an arbitrary vote and allow all present seemingly equal participation. Yet the reality is that the white crew members cannot bring themselves to publicly admit the slave's expendable status, nor can they, for that matter, admit within the public domain how their masculinity and noble social stature take from and definition from the notion of the slave as consumable object. Such scenarios raise a number of unanswered questions. Why did the white men feel compelled to present an image of equal status with the slave? Why did they feel the need to hide their honorific social stature or to act outside of the extant master-slave white-black power dynamic? The empty lot-drawing ritual reflects the sense of dishonor that Americans associated with human consumption, at least publicly. Though isolated and dazed from civilization, the white crew cannot bring themselves to acknowledge the larger culture of black consumption. They cannot bring themselves to embrace, in a public and ritualized manner, the honorific and fraternal social bonds that the enslaved man's consumption reifies and sustains. If these white men, isolated and stranded at sea, could not bring themselves to claim the import and reality of black consumption, one can only imagine the depths of repression and silence within broader 19th century American culture. Again, it should cause us to wonder how many other blacks did whites consume at sea, and how thoroughly have white Americans and perhaps other groups of American citizens repressed this social reality. In Nantucket, most of the white community agreed to maintain a tight-lipped silence concerning the consumption of a black man at sea. In addition to preserving white male honor, Nantucketers needed to preserve the integrity of their industry. If the truth about the consumption of black men was widely distributed, it would have affected their economy, their ability to recruit black ship hands. Because colonial-era whites had so much to lose, by way of property, repute, and livelihood, we should regard our acknowledgement of the Essex and Peggy incidents as only the starting point of a discussion that will, with the recovery of more precise historical evidence, deepen and complicate our understandings of the consumption of blacks at sea.
Wowee. Context of white supremacy. End of the first audio segment. We will pick up, we are still in chapter 2, we will pick up the subheading, The Meaning and Practice of Seasoning. I am excited for that. If you would like to participate, the number to dial 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone to call in, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tiny.cc/1race. Race, and that is the number 1. What do you put in that address? Click the link on the left of the page. You'll see it says free vote line. When you click that, it will open a small window on your screen. Top line, it's a drop down menu. Select the number that I just gave out. Again, it's 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for a code. That code again is 564-943. Phone line, it will ask for a name. You can use your real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure if you would like to participate. You will see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 61. That'll just fast forward through the whole process. I'll see your hand on the switchboard, and we will get you on the line. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, line should be open. If you have comments to share, feel free. If you could take about 5 minutes or so to make your commentary, that would be grand. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. This is Ami. I wanted to comment primarily on one thing that I observed in this passage or this portion of the reading. And that is, I can totally understand why the gender sexuality, women's studies, gender queer theory departments and all that stuff would, encourage the reading of this book or like this book. It's not in any way a indictment of particularly white males homosexualizing and cannibalizing specifically black males at all. And I'd like to, when we say that they experience shame and guilt, that implies that some type of emotion around that and what might look like shame and guilt, I don't necessarily know given the other things that I've been studying about white psychology and pathology that, I mean, a narcissist can display emotion, like can act an emotion, but it doesn't mean that they actually feel that. And I think that's what a lot of this is. Just because you think you keep things hidden and you vilify it outright, like in the front, or you say that, oh, I really condemn this and I don't like this behavior and blah, 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 blah. But then you turn around and behind closed doors, you're doing it. Does not mean that you're actually, you feel any shame around that. I think that's just a white tactic. Like, I don't think that there's any emotion around feeling bad at all about what they've done then or now. Even like saying, well, we don't want to talk about it because we feel bad. I disagree. I think they don't want to talk about it because they don't want us to know about it. Because if we know about it as people who are sentient, they're going to be like, excuse me, what? Like, no. And we'll begin to put them in proper context. So I don't think it has anything to do with feeling bad at all about anything. And the part where they're on the whaling ship and supposedly there was a really, really bad storm and they ate just everything before they turned around and ate that black man, that could possibly be a lie. There's nothing to say that that actually happened. There could have been no storm and they just go around doing something like the lottery, selecting black men that they're going to devour in some ritual process. It's eerily reminiscent of Moby Dick. I haven't seen the whole movie, but I did watch one clip and it was like this whole ritual. There's a terrible storm. They're on the boat and there's like one race of each male and the white male is like screaming in the rain. And, you know, that's a ritual process too. So I just thought, I just wanted to assert or put out there that the book, although it has great information, and I'm still thoroughly enjoying participating in the reading. It is slightly forgiving of white men and their grotesque behavior. I don't think that you can say that you risk, like, that you can love and have affection for somebody and then turn around and abuse them. That's, you just want them. And then it also, one other thing, I'm sorry, it had me think of S&M, people who participate in that sexual experience or whatever, where they like dress in black and there's a gimp or something, or a slave or a sub and a dom or a master, that whole thing. Like, I mean, it just puts white sexual pathology and psychology in context. So I'm enjoying it, but I wanted to say that. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. This book is fascinating on investigating the homoeroticism and cannibalism, two of the things that I probably didn't know that much about. I come to find out that, you know, there's different types of cannibalism. The endocannibalism, consumption of the flesh of a person who is a member of your own family or social or cultural group. Exocannibalism, consumption of the flesh of a person who is not a member of your own group or an outsider. And that consumption be based on rage, disdain, and humiliation, and to instill fear. Then the auto-cannibalism, self-cannibalism, process of eating oneself or forced to eat one's own flesh. And then he goes on the other medical, innocent cannibalism, psychosexual, and so on. But it's an education in some of the concepts that you wouldn't ordinarily think of, because it's he brings his point home, because he gives you these instances, and then if you can think about you view these different types and combine that with the unnatural attraction that a person have for the same sex, you can see how the black enslaved person could be looked at as a commodity, bought and sold, and then used as something to help define the status and satisfy the appetite of whites. You know, like you see in that instance, the Kentucky slave owner, Lyman Lewis, who had the slave George. And I just think, you know, it's exceptionally horrendous that they had George's brother was used to help hold him down. And then the door was closed and locked. He had all the other slaves in there to witness the murder. And then the quartering, butchering, and then cooking of George. You know, it shows that, the book points out that he was, you know, picking on George before, you know, like single him out, you know, for excessive treatment. You know, and the closest thing, you know, I can think visual is, you know, when you think about that movie, it was Solomon Northrup, you know, where the young lady was picking a lot of cotton and she was a sexual desire of the slave master, but he beat her, you know, the most viciously. So it's something that connects all of this together. We know that rape is a violent act. And so this eroticism and violence and this desire to humiliate and to consume the enslaved person, you know, body, mind, and soul is just, you know, it becomes a reality the way that he gives these examples. You can imagine if you're the only black person on a shipwreck and you got a bunch of white men around you and they're running out of food, you know. Well, you know that you're probably going to be the first one to go. And whether they actually did that by not giving him food during the shipwreck, or while they were sailing, was starving, intermittently starving those black enslaved people. Then it would amount to the same thing once that they got on the boat, you know, and they being that very tiny minority, then I would put my guess on the fact that they murdered those people first before they ate them. And I'll mute my line on that, give somebody else a chance. Thanks for taking the call. No.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, guys. Good evening to all the callers. To the lead caller, I agree. You didn't really need a reason to start eating a black person. Just wanted to bring up a few points. They said they would mummify people for medicinal, so they could eat them later for medicinal purposes. And, you know, we haven't had all this talk about medicinal marijuana. I was just, like, I mean, you know, you go to a person dispensary, you know, I need a toe. I mean, it just sounds so white, you know, how they do things. Also, and I'm never drinking an Nantucket nectar again. And I'm never going on a cruise. I think those are two things that I'm definitely not going to do. Because 9 times out of 10, if you're on a cruise, you'll definitely be outnumbered by white people, and that's a lot of white people. I mean, they're going to have a feast. It was just reading the perspective and the way this guy's approaching it is very interesting. And it's, you know, Roz has been talking about this book to me for almost a whole year, and I'm just hearing it now and participating in a study session. I mean, it just really just slams, and this system, you know, just shows how grotesque and deviant these people are, both sexually and, I guess, they're hungry. Also, you know, being black and being consumed still in so many ways by the system of white supremacy and white people who maintain and control that system. It probably explains why we're the biggest consumers. Just deep back of our mind, knowing that we're being consumed, you know, we have no real freedom, you know. It just, you know, we find pleasure in things we can consume. I just think that, from last week, I was just thinking about that, like, wow. It's just a very interesting way to approach dissecting the system. And I never would have thought of it this way. Are there any books that have the white woman's consumption of the black woman? I would wonder. Because I would maintain that a lot of the sexual deviant behaviors that we explain, we inherited from them, and not just men. I'm in my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, to Thomas in New York, Mr. Demery, Emmy, all the other callers and listeners. It's great to hear that your baritone has returned. I hope your voice your throat feels better. It sounds like you feel better, so I hope you're okay. Wow. This book, I read it before, but to be honest, there's nothing like reading it with the Cal's listeners. It's just so enlightening. And I wanted to start at the very beginning of the chapter where he writes, all we know for sure is that George, like many on the plantation, often went hungry, suffered the lash too often, and grew to despise and resist his conditions of bondage. George provoked his master's penchant for punishment by frequently running away, in addition to disobeying. Sent to the spring one day to collect water into an elegant pitcher, George made the hard mistake of letting the pitcher fall and standing by and watching it as it dashed to shivers on the rocks. As punishment for George's transgression, his master bound him to a wooden plank and, in the manner of a butcher, quartered him with an axe and cooked his severed body parts in pieces of flesh over a billowing fire. Excuse me, what stands out to me at that is the way that he was objectified to be worth less than a quote-unquote elegant pitcher. And to that symbolism of him being made to suffer the same sort of quartering that went that happened to the pitcher when he dropped and shattered it really brings to mind the idea of black life being worth or blacks being life unworthy of life, and how we as black people interpret that same thing in the way that we treat each other. I remember an incident during the crack era when I was a child of a black male shooting and killing another black male because when he went to rob him, he did not have enough money for the addict to get drugs. He had a quarter on him. So because he didn't have at least $20 for the guy to be able to get his crack, he shot him to death right there on the spot. And to me, that was that thinking of reading that section made me think of the symbology of that quarter and that black male's life being worth less than a quarter because the addict was so intensely starving for his next fix. There's so much stuff that I highlighted from my first reading of the book. And now I'm highlighting even more with the second reading of the book. A theme that stands out to me is the idea of, like Emmy said, and our Thomas in New York alluded to, this idea of shame. And it really has, and also along with that shame, the secrecy. And the secrecy having to do with us as victims of white supremacy coming to an understanding of the subhuman or subanimal behavior of these creatures, these disagreeable beings that we call white people. And the only way to keep the false idea that these people are somehow human, that they're somehow in the human family, is to obfuscate, like you always say, the reality of their savage behavior. And the whole idea of the way that they function and this shame. The shame, there is no shame in what they do. What it is just the exposure of what they actually do. And if you study their culture, even in their so-called entertainment, I call it entertainment, a lot of themes, the most famous themes you have are themes in which they function or they look like normal people. And then behind closed doors, they turn into cannibalistic monsters. Whether you're talking about Jekyll and Hyde, vampires, the whole idea of a vampire looking like a normal person. And when they get you behind closed doors, they consume you by sucking your blood. Werewolves, they look like human beings. Then in the full moon, they become something different. Rove the mountainside at night and consume other people. So if you look at this, they basically have been telling us culturally in their expression of entertainment exactly who and what they are and have always been. And I think that we culturally, because we're so different, we don't actually see them for who and what they are. We actually fool ourselves. I think it's a form of Stockholm syndrome. And also just disbelief in the fact that there are humanoid creatures that would behave in a manner that is so opposite to what we as black people have ever experienced or practiced ourselves. Also, there's a section on page 62 where he writes, Orlando Patterson writes that the master's sense of honor was derived directly from the degradation of his slave, beginning in childhood and continuing through life in his despotic exercise of power. And then later on, he writes, elsewhere, Patterson emphasizes that the master generally camouflages this association of honor with a master's relationship to the slave so as not to reveal his dependence, his parasitism of the slave. John Hope Franklin posits honor was the most central defining characteristic of 19th century Southerner culture. The honor of the Southerner, Franklin proclaims, caused him to defend with his life the slightest suggestion of irregularity in his honesty or integrity, and he was fiercely sensitive to any imputation that might cast a shadow on the character of the women in his family. To him, nothing was more important than honor. Indeed, he placed it above wealth, art, learning, and other quote-unquote delicacies of urban civilization, and regarded its protection as a continuing preoccupation. And it's really interesting that white people based their honor on the degree of their racist abuse of black people, which is essentially what it's saying. So that in and of itself is a form, and like they said earlier in the text, of parasitism or, again, consumption or cannibalism. And these are all things that that really bring home white psychopathology in a profound way. I'm going to touch on one last thing, or maybe two, but before I get off, but there's a section on page 65 where he writes, the social consumption of the enslaved person was such a concern in the colonial United States that senators, religious leaders, and abolitionists heatedly debated whether colonial America was becoming something akin to a cannibal nation. Among 19th century abolitionists and other conscionable persons, the central issue was not the liberation and unburdening of the African soul, but the moral implications for whites who were fast developing what many literally referred to as a cannibalistic hunger for black flesh. In the public domain, where this debate took place, whites regarded human consumption as a dishonorable act. Shame, national degradation, and widespread anxiety shaped the national debate, leaving no room for consideration of the secret codes of honor that white men maintained quietly amongst themselves. And that section speaks to what Dr. Marimba Ani calls white rhetorical ethics, but on a national scale, which again lends to something that I've said countless times on this program, that white people function as a racist superorganism, so they function collectively with the same mindset of this cannibalization and a consumption and racist destruction of black life. And finally, I found it very interesting while reading the text, they use the term fugitive to describe a runaway slave. And if you look at the term fugitive, that is the same term that is applied to prisoners, criminals who escape the prison industrial complex are called fugitives. So they're telling you that really slavery was a penal system of consumption. And anytime a slave rebelled or was recalcitrant in their terms and rebelled against being consumed in that form of fashion and decided to run away, they were treated the same way that criminals in modern times and criminals in earlier times in American history and culture were treated. And once they were caught, they set themselves up for even more demonic and diabolical forms of consumption just via the fact that they decided to escape an insane scenario. And they were viewed as having drapetomania, meaning that they had to be insane to run away from white supremacy or attempt to rebel against white supremacy. Thank you very much, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. Is there anybody that we missed? Anybody had a hand up that we've not heard from?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and the rest of the callers and the listeners on the line. It's Rob in Milwaukee. Stood out. Really bringing in the context the behavior of Jeffrey Dahmer. I think I was just becoming a teenager when that whole case was taking place, and thinking back as a child, it was really big. Like, everybody in the city was referred to as a cannibal. That was like the running joke. This is the first book study where I've actually bought the text. So it's much easier for me to follow along. The first session, I know I said it was a little harder for me to grasp some of the concepts. I think one of the callers said he was having that same problem. But it's a lot easier now that I have the text. And just want to point out one thing. On page 74, and I was still processing it a little bit, I guess, and I wanted to read it. Maybe some of the other listeners can add clarification. It goes, an 1807 visitor to Nantucket agreeing with Comstock wrote, "The Negroes, though they are to be prized for their habits of obedience, are not as intelligent as the Indians, and none of them attain the rank of boat, steerer, and mate." And that stood out. And I was thinking, is the color code, is that on display in that text right there? And I was wondering how in the encounter with the whites, with the non-white people, how was it that the quote-unquote Indian people were seemed to be more intelligent than the Negroes? And last thing that I'll touch on, this text really brings into context for me the fascination of oral sex in the mainstream society. And thank you for taking the call, and I'll mute my line.
Interesting. It would seem the racists, they would be the ones that could best explain the whatever the Indians, quote-unquote, did to impress them with their intelligence, or at least more intelligence than that of the Negroes. I guess we could, folks here could guess, but, you know, the racists of that time, they could probably best detail the particulars or give us the particulars of that. Do folks want to respond to Rob in Wisconsin, his question, query about that particular section? I think he said it was on page 74. This is the Nantucket incident where they've eaten a black person on one of these enslaving ships. And he says an 1807 visitor to Nantucket agreeing with Comstock wrote, "The Negroes, though they are prized, though they are to be prized for their habits of obedience, are not as intelligent as the Indians, and none of them attained the rank of boat steerer and mate." I think his question was, is the color code on display there? Folks want to respond to that?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I would like to answer that question. In my opinion, they are using the color code, because when you look at the hierarchy in this country, you had two different groups of Indians. You had the black indigenous people, and then you have what they would term the mongoloid indigenous people, which are the ones that they solely refer to as Native Americans today. And in a lot of cases, you had those so-called mongoloid Native Americans actually worked with white people to subjugate and in some cases kill the black indigenous people. And also the whole idea, when they wrote the section about none of them had attained the rank of boat steerer or mate.
Crime case.
Lead any sort of charge in the game. And on a boat, white people are supposed to be in the dominant position and in control. So they would never let any non-white person attain any level as far as their position on the boat, where they would be in any position to control anything. The same way in football, all of the so-called brains of the operation would be the quarterback, and it's only in recent times you started to see black quarterbacks. That's my opinion. So, I mean, as far as just the way that appears, but I definitely think the color code was being applied in that case. Thank you.
Yes, I'd like to say that my opinion on that is when you look at the enslaved person being used on the ships, they were very rarely given the opportunities to demonstrate any intelligence. They were used in menial tasks and heavy lifting and the likes, you know. So when would they ever have the opportunity to demonstrate any abilities as for its skills and intelligent aptitude? I mean, my line.
I will share a few notes, then if anyone else, if you want to respond to how wacky. The whole switchboard disappeared for a moment. Anyway, as I'm rebooting my switchboard, I'll share a few notes, and then if any other folks that are with us, if you want to respond to Rob in Wisconsin, his question, or if you just, you know, have additional thoughts, comments that you want to share, we'll make time for that as well. Some of the quick notes wanted to share from the text. Really enjoyed this week's section. I've enjoyed the book overall, but chapter two, and we haven't even finished chapter two, but the portion that we've read of chapter two thus far, wow, great section, great piece of writing. So some of the things that stood out, when he starts off with this racist enslaver, Lewis, and he has literally butchered this enslaved black male. And he says when his wife asked the cause of the dreadful scream she had heard, he said that he had never enjoyed himself so well at a ball as he had enjoyed himself that evening. Lewis's response to his wife, as disturbing and incongruous as it is, puts this entire scenario into context. Number one, the number of times that he says context in this book alone is worthy of being on the cows, and I hope this book further evidences why this program is titled as such. But that, I just thought that was such an important passage. I think Roz talked about it because he has several passages that kind of just reinforce that point, that what does it mean to be classified as white, and the joy, the pleasure. Also making Emmy's point about there is no guilt. There is tremendous satisfaction with abusing Negras. Just really appreciated that, and I felt like he really emphasized that point throughout chapter two. His interrogation of metaphors, I super appreciate, being someone who encourages people to pay attention to metaphors regularly for a variety of reasons. I am so thankful and just really enjoying him taking time to deconstruct these metaphors. What do they mean? Are things being said subconsciously that are conveying more truth about people's thoughts, feelings, motivations? Just wow. And him dissecting the use of the metaphor, the ball, in this particular sentence where the metaphor used. I had so much fun butchering this nigra. It was more fun than me going to a ball. I know Dr. Welsing, where he says the metaphor of the ball is significant insofar as it goes to you go to, insofar as one goes to a ball with someone. Lewis would, under normal circumstances, attend a ball with his wife, dancing with her, holding her close, smelling and touching her body. Instead, we have George as the unwilling, feminized partner and conjugal mate. It is George whom the master touches, smells, violently lavishes with attention and care, and ingests with the same relish that he would hors d'oeuvres, fine music, or cocktails served at an open bar at a ball. George and his ritualized punishment reify and ennoble Lewis's white male identity. Powerful feelings of satiation, leisurely comfort, and pleasure accompany Lewis's cannibalization of George. Just extremely powerful set of sentences, I think, deconstructing this whole narrative. And I think that this is not an isolated aspect of white supremacy. This is a core aspect of white culture, white identity, right up 21st century. Continuing, let's see. I think a lot of this sheet where he puts this, he frames this as there is a white code around, we don't want to publicize our consumption, cannibalization of black bodies. So we're going to have a code about doing this, or we won't put this out. We're talking about this publicly. I think that that is just tremendous, because that's exactly what it is. I think that same code is in effect today. Again, I really appreciated him kind of making that point consistently throughout the reading this week. Again, quoting Orlando Patterson, where he says the master's sense of honor, I just read that as white identity. Your honor as a white man, a white woman, a white child was directly derived from the degradation of his slaves, beginning in childhood and continuing through his life in his despotic exercise of power. That is white existence, any era. Continuing, really thought it was just tremendous when he goes through and unpacks all of these different people using the metaphor of cannibalism to describe slavery, or to describe capitalism, really just to describe white conduct in general, in the Northwestern Hemisphere during the 19th century. And I think it's a fitting metaphor. I think even at the beginning of the book, when he started off with the notion of a parasitic relationship between whites and black people, absolutely. I think we've used the term vampiric on the program before, which still same connotation, devouring the flesh, literal consumption of another person, a black person. Continuing. Let's see some of the other major points. I'm really looking forward to getting to the portion about Nat Turner. I think a lot of this consumption, I think, too, he does a great job of unpacking the homoerotic sexual nature of this consumption, even if there is not direct intercourse, even just using a metaphor like the ball with all that's implied about that, giving some sort of a sexual connotation with describing, talking about just the abuse, murder, even in some instances, butchering, torturing of black people in sexual connotations. I think that's a huge point. Same thing that Pam gets at, Renithia Tate gets at on a regular basis in their writing times that they've been on the program. Let's see. I thought it was really important, the projection where he says accusations of cannibalism have served as a handy tool in the arsenal of conquest. Furthermore, the creation of Africans and Native Americans as cannibals has allowed European Americans to refashion themselves as anything but cannibalistic, erasing in the process their European legacies of cannibalism and their newly developed appetites and hungers for flesh in the New World. Great, again, piece of writing. And I think this is consistent. I think we've talked about this on the program before, where whites, they are phenomenal at projection onto black people, non-white people on the whole. All of the things that they do, they just project onto black people, non-white people, when they're really just talking about themselves. I know Dr. Welsing has talked about this on a regular basis also. Let's see, a few more. Yeah, I thought it was great that he brought up within the body of the text, because I think a lot of times when you get these accounts in terms of what happened on the Essex slave ship, where they reportedly ate these four Negroes after they died of natural causes, that sort of thing just gets accepted. A white person said it, so it's got to be true, and we just move forward. I thought it was great that that was included in the body of text, that they could have just been lying. They could have just out and out killed the, hey, we're going to kill these Negroes and eat them, and that'll just be that. And we'll just put it in the log that, you know, he slipped on a bar of soap, and, you know, he got the measles or whatever. We'll just write it up however we do. Same thing that they do now. He had a gun and knife, so we had to kill him. I appreciated that that was brought up within the text both times and interrogated, that, you know, if these are racists who are committing cannibalism, why would we think that they would not lie or, you know, commit some other, you know, inhumane act against a black person? Let's see. Yeah, I thought it was great. Even he went so far as to interrogate other whites who've talked about this incident and just chalked it up to bad luck that the Negroes died first, to just out and out that this is how whites practice racism. They lie. They do not use logic. They support other white people's lies, even throughout history, where this will be a generational thing of protecting and defending white lies and previous racists. Let's see. I thought it was great as well, this notion, same thing that you see now with the racists are Trump and his supporters. Everybody else, all the whites that oppose Trump, they are not racists and are A-okay. Same notion here where it's, we think, oh, the whites in New England, Nantucket, they're great. They're abolitionists. These are the people that gave, you know, good old Frederick Douglass a place to hide and helped lots of black people get free. And right on, these are the coolest white people ever. Spirit of John Brown, when he totally rejects that and saying that's, number one, this incident, the Essex up in Nantucket, that they were eating black people, and then they had the same racist white supremacist ideology, where he says Comstock came closest to revealing a hidden racial reality behind the consumption of black males in the 19th century. Comstock revealed that although Nantucket stood as a stronghold of abolitionism, the community at large still maintained ideas of blacks as lacking humanity and as best suited to the roles of slaves and servants. to white masters. Thought that was important. Whites can disagree with other whites about how they're practicing racism. And I think you even see the same dynamic right now. A lot of times we get confused. White people will disagree about the business of white supremacy. That doesn't mean that they're not racist. A lot of times white people are so slick they know they can get away with that, where they will appear that they are not racist if they come out and attack another white person for how they are conducting themselves with niggers. And they know that a lot of black people will be fooled. They're, oh, yeah, this is a good white person. They're not racist. That's not what it is. They just have a different business plan about how the plantation should be run. You're seeing the same thing right now with Donald Trump that he's talking about here in Nantucket, where these quote-unquote abolitionists, they disagree with whites in the South. Just means they have a different business plan for how white supremacy should be run. Last thing I'll get in. I took a lot more notes this time. I thought it was great. I think Roz, he had mentioned Dr. Marimba Anis' rhetorical ethic. I did as well. I picked it at a different point where he says, curiously, in the Peggy, this is the incident where they ate the one black male and said, where they said, oh, we're gonna do straws. We'll have a draw and see who we're gonna eat. But the whites had already colluded. Oh yeah, we're gonna get the nigger. Where he says, curiously, in the Peggy incident, whites employ rituals of democracy and fairness to disguise for themselves and the slave the real nature of the social contract. I was reminded of Charles Mills, The Social Contract. He's been a guest on this program where he says basically white people, white men, white women, they agree we're going to work together worldwide to dominate niggers. He was a guest on the program back in 2010. I was also reminded, as I said, Dr. Marimba Ani rhetorical ethic, where they do this sort of thing all the time to trick victims into thinking that, oh, they are about justice and quote unquote fairness and doing the right thing. And nothing could be further from the truth, where they come out and just, they get together, they have their little clandestine meeting about what they're going to do, what we're going to say, get our lies straight. And then they go out and say, oh, yes. And yes, we'll be righteous about this and we'll have a prayer and God bless. Okay. And we already got our plan about how we're going to commit all of our crimes of rape and dastardly deeds. They are really, really good at being able to put a great spin on things so that they look great. That's what being a master deceiver is all about. Really appreciated that sentence. I think I can, rituals too, just that word rituals, very important, suggesting religion, nothing stronger. The religion of white supremacy, that's what we should think about all of this as. Folks have any other comments they wanted to get in? We have about 10 minutes or so. If you had other comments, wanted to respond.
Have you heard?
Yep, heard both of you. We'll get Rob in Wisconsin.
Real quick, just to what you touched on about the picking of the straws, what this text really brought to mind for me was whites are really into putting on a show, and it really put me in the mind of the political theater that takes place. And I mute my line. Thank you.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Peace to Rob. Wanted to say, Rob made a great point earlier when he made a point about all of the fixation with oral sex and bringing that to light in their current entertainment paradigm. Just, you know, reading this book puts that into a whole other perspective as well. Making the Africans and Indians look like cannibals. I think that's the same thing they're doing today. As far as they're the cannibals, but they were able to make it look like the Africans are the cannibals and the Indians, even in the cartoons where, you know, the black people, back in the old Bugs Bunny cartoons, you know, Warner Brothers, where all the cannibals are about to cook someone. I think they're doing the same thing today with homosexuality. I'm using entertainment to propagate that mostly the black male, even the female now, having very prominent black females displayed prominently as dressing like men. And also in all these shows, it's a black homosexual male, very effeminate, I think that's the same thing they're doing to make it look like we're the ones, not them. I wonder if the taste of black flesh is better to the cannibals, the white cannibals. That's just one thing I always wonder, you know, like, is it that they like the taste of this black meat? Is it a different taste? I would like to point out that another form of consumption, working at the hospital, they have a whole wall, huge wall, with all these different pictures of people who have donated their organs after death. And majority, overwhelming majority, are black and young. And I just see that as another form of consumption, you know. All these people are very young on this world. I don't see too many old people. And they died young so they could consume their organs, which I'm sure are mostly going to white people. And the last very small point I wanted to make out, consumption will fit great in your definition, Gus. You say dedicated to the abuse, subjugation, and consumption, you know, of non-white people. Because that's really what they're doing. I mean, I think.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus. Yeah, I want to piggyback off of Thomas in New York. I thought that Rob had a brilliant assessment in regards to the oral sex aspect, especially so-called interracial oral sex and the act of simulated consumption via the act itself or the consumption of body fluids at the point of ejaculation. It just merely made me think, and I like the fact that Rob brought that up. I wanted to read the section right before the one that you read on the Peggy incident because I thought it was kind of telling. It says on that same page, this our page, page 75. It says, the starving crew faced a dreadful decision who to eat first among their crew. It appeared the crew drew lots, with the result that the Negro was chosen as the first person to be murdered and consumed. In actuality, the white crew decided before they drew lots that they would kill and eat the enslaved man. According to Petrinovich, the lot had been consulted only for the sake of form because the black was prescribed the moment the sailors first formed their resolution. Unspoken codes of superiority and group honor dictated the white crew's relationship to the slave. As a choice object of consumption, the black man reifies the bonds of fraternity, dominion, and right to life shared among the white men. In the choice to kill and consume the black man, the white man reinforced the premium value of white masculinity. The dishonorable and illogical act would have been to choose a white man over a slave. Such a choice would have violated the unspoken racial contract among whites and would have gone against the logic of the slave as an expendable, consumable object. The feast that follows, reinforces this white male bond, and I put homosexual in the book, homosexual bond in ideology and appetite. One of the crew ate the liver raw. Some of the rest of the body was cooked and the remainder cut up and referred to as steaks, was pickled with the head and fingers thrown overboard. There was so much that was, I feel, stood out in this particular section. And the fact that they said that they had chosen to kill the black person before they drew the lots, really, in my opinion, because he spoke right after that of an unspoken code, because of that unspoken code of white superiority and the premium value put on white male life, I think that the fact that they were going to kill him was unspoken. What they discussed was how they were going to go about fooling him into thinking that they were going to do something equitable and so-called fair by casting lots. So they already knew without having to tell one another, yeah, we're going to kill this nigga and eat him. And they conferred with one another on how they were going to fool this black person into thinking that he actually was chosen by some sort of process that was equitable. Also, when they discuss, where is it? When they talk about the slave as an expendable, consumable object and the fact that they refer to the cut-up body parts as steaks, really speaks to the fact that we were seen as human cows to them, and that they made the basically made the entire continent, North American portion of the continent, a plantation farm in which it was black people that were being farmed as the cow. And when they were eating us, they would cut us up and make us into steaks, which is what they do with cattle today. You go to the store, you get a nice piece of steak wrapped up in some, you know, styrofoam and plastic, you take it home and eat it. So really, if you look at it, we were always looked at as this consumable object. And I just think it must have been terrifying for our ancestors to have to go through something like that, no different than, you know, cows or chickens or any other farm animals that they consume. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Yes, Mayor?
Yes, sir.
Just one last thing. The speech that Horace Mann was giving, you know, he was an abolitionist, and you could see in his speech that it wasn't for the liberation of the black person or, you know, to take the burden off of them of slavery. It was trying to prick the consciousness of the whites, you know, to the point that they were becoming cannibals. So it wasn't anything to benefit the blacks, but to prick their conscience about what they were becoming. And I have one last question, if someone on the line could tell me, what is that instrument that's on the cover of the book? It's probably something that's used as an instrument of terror and torture of black people. I'll mute my line.
My suspicion, I was thinking that too, for people who you can look on Twitter. I have a picture of the front cover of the book, so you can see what Mr. Demrefort is talking about at Until Justice. At Until Justice. But yeah, I was thinking the same thing. My suspicion is that this will come up in the book. Now, I could be incorrect about that. I have not read this book before. But my suspicion is, yeah, they will explain that. I can't imagine getting through a whole book and not having an explanation as to what that is, not getting a clue about that at some point. So, yeah, I think we should maybe just listen out, stay tuned, and it should come up as we roll through the text.
Can I answer that question? Because I know what it is.
Does it come up later in the text?
I think they do discuss it, but it's funny, actually, because of what it is and what it's used for, is really interesting. But it's actually on the back of the back cover of the book. If you look at the very bottom left side above where it says New York University Press, it actually tells you what it's called, but I researched this a while ago. It's called the Speculum Oris. And what it was used for was that any time a slave did not want to eat, they would basically close it up, and it was actually the two prongs close up into like look like one flat object. They usually knock out the front teeth of the slave, ram that into their mouths, and they twist that heart-looking object to force open the mouth so that they can shove food into the slave's mouth to make them eat in order for them to make the journey across the Atlantic during the transatlantic journey. That's what that's used for. It's called the Speculum Oris, O-R-I-S, and Speculum is S-P-E-C-U-L-U-M, Speculum Oris, and it's used to force feed slaves.
Thank you, Ron.
You're welcome. That's, again, consumption, but in reverse. The black slaves have to be forced to consume food so we can take you to the U.S. to further consume you once you land on the shores of America.
I saw it used in a movie. I can't think of which one, but I'm thinking Goodbye, Uncle Tom, where they showed it actually being used. It could have even been the newer roots, but I'm pretty sure it was in a movie, and they showed it, and it was would knock out the front teeth, very grotesque.
You're right, Thomas. It was Goodbye, Uncle Thomas. They showed the use of it.
They show it on Birth of a Nation as well.
Hmm. The person that called in 4499, did you have commentary?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How you doing, Gus?
Right poorly.
Right poorly, I agree. But you got the best show on the planet. I was calling. What I got from this book so far. I know Nellie Fuller says that they haven't killed us all because of who put us here, but it almost seemed like they ain't killed us all, because if you were eating us, it'd be like a farmer killing all his food. Like, you wouldn't kill all the chickens before they laid the next egg. You wouldn't kill all your cows before they laid the calves or birthed the calves. And I'm starting to think, are we just here for food? I mean, the best way to keep your food fresh is to keep it alive. And it's just, I'm starting to wonder, is that why they haven't killed us all? Because, I mean, they've had the opportunity to. And I'm just wondering, are we fresh food? And that's just an observation I got from this year, from the book so far. I just wanted to share that with you.
All right. That'll be our last comment before we get to the second audio. If folks have additional comments that they want to get in, just make a note, and we should have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. I know to the last person that shared, I know Mr. Fuller has, I've heard him say on numerous occasions, with that exact logic, that racists, they have made their purpose for being here to abuse, as it states in the text that we just heard from chapter 2 repeatedly, that is the code of honor. That's the highest form of enjoyment, is mistreating Negroes. So why on earth would I get rid of all the Negroes when that's the thing that I enjoy doing more than anything, stomping on and mistreating them? I've heard Mr. Fuller say that exactly. I think even on this program, that is never on the agenda to kill all of the black people. You need them so you can have someone to stomp on and look down on. But yeah, we will pick that up second audio segment. So we're still in chapter 2. Vincent Woodard, the delectable Negro, still in chapter 2, context of white supremacy. We will be right back after we finish up. We're going to finish the remainder of the chapter. Second audio segment beginning now.
The meaning and practice of seasoning. In the public domain, whites, I have shown, either repressed the topic of human consumption or spoke of the consumed slave as a philosophical and moral issue. However, the slaves, having less to lose, described their enslavement as a form of appetite and Epicurean hunger for black flesh that whites cultivated in the context of physical abuse, sexualized abuses, and all manner of daily master-slave relations. In John S. Jacobs' slave narrative, entitled A True Tale of Slavery, he frequently described scenes he witnessed on the plantation in a language suggestive of consumption. He opened his narrative by describing the slave trader as a human fleshmonger. His own masters he describes as hungry heirs to a general feast of blood. This feast included black men who were hunted down and beheaded, and slaves who were beaten so that their flesh was like a steak. One narrative contained in the massive collection The American Slave, a composite autobiography, describes how male slaves were beaten and then hanged up in the smokehouse by their thumbs. Such punishment rituals were a form of seasoning. And seasoning usually involved breaking the will of a man or woman who was to be gradually conditioned to the life of the slave through physical and psychological torture. Lerone Bennett Jr. describes the process thusly. This process of seasoning, whether it took place in liberal Brazil or harsh South Carolina, was a painful mind-reversing operation in which 2 or 3 out of every 10 died. In one form or another, every slave from Africa went through a breaking-in period. During this period, which varied from 1 to 3 years, the slave was taught pidgin English or French or Spanish. He got a new name and began to look at himself and others in a different manner. Seasoning is typically thought of as occurring at the point when the slave descends from the slave ship and is formally introduced into a plantation setting. Yet seasoning was a process that could and did occur throughout the career of the slave. Eli Coleman described a typical seasoning process that involved chaining a recalcitrant slave who had already been introduced to the plantation to a tree, so that when he was finally released, plantation life felt something like freedom compared with his more degraded condition. Coleman recalls, "So Master done put a chain round his legs, so he just hardly walk, and he has to work in the field that way. At night he put another chain round his neck and fastened it to a tree. After 3 weeks, Master turned him loose, and that the proudest nigger in the world, and hardest working nigger Master have after that." Webster's Encyclopedic Unabridged Dictionary offers distinct yet overlapping definitions for seasoning that apply to the treatment of the black slave. I cite just two. To heighten or improve the flavor of food by adding condiments, spices, herbs, or the like. To dry or otherwise treat lumber so as to harden it and render it immune to shrinkage, warpage, etc. Definition 17 is how historians and other scholars of slavery typically convey the purpose and outcome of seasoning. As a process that hardens or numbs the slave psychologically and physically to the brutality of his or her condition. The latter definition, while partially accurate, does not account for the way seasoning rituals also cultivated the master or overseer. It was in the context of seasoning that the master developed certain appetites for the slave, learned to channel needs, pleasure, sport, and eroticism into the brutal treatment of the slave. At the same time that it numbed and hardened, seasoning also had the outcome of softening the flesh and, for the master, heightening and improving the flavor of certain types of interactions. There was a distinct category of seasoning rituals that involved literally seasoning the human flesh. These rituals, which usually went beyond the bounds of normal punishment, provide evidence of seasoning as an epicurean process that prepared the slave for social consumption. I have already mentioned Virginia sport, which involved hanging a person up in the meat house after a beating and literally smoking the body. Often, a master would beat a slave until raw and bloody, and then the master would apply the seasoning. For example, Wes Brady witnessed his master, following a beating, take a brick and grind it up in a powder and mix it with lard and put it all over him, the slave, and roll him in a sheet. Others frequently use, among other combinations, salt and pepper, vinegar, salt, and pepper, pepper and turpentine, and coal oil and turpentine. It was not enough to have slaves as a laboring commodity. Whites who enacted such heinous acts satiated cravings, took pleasure and delight in Negroes thusly treated, like Master Tom, who just about had to beat somebody every day to satisfy his craving. He had a big bullwhip, and he stake a nigga on the ground and make another nigga hold his head down with his mouth in the dirt and whip the nigga until blood run down and red out and red up the ground. Historians of slavery have typically described such acts as cruel and unnecessary forms of punishment. Yet the descriptors cruel, unusual, and punishment do not adequately define the craven, the institutionalized hunger, and often characterize the master's relationship to his slaves and, more specifically, to his male slaves. James L. Smith, Seasoning at the Hands of a Man to Whom His Master Had Rented Him, exemplifies how sex, brutality, and hunger all coalesce within the economy of slavery. In Smith's Slave Narrative, Autobiography of James L. Smith, sexual and physical brutality converge. Smith's narrative offers a closer look into the sexual dimensions of white male rage, obsession, and desire for black men during slavery. As a youth, Smith works on the Mitchell Plantation. One sunny morning, a ship captain comes to the Mitchell Plantation to purchase grain. This man sees young Smith and admires his countenance. He wants to make the youth into a sailor, initiate him into the rigors and challenges of manhood at sea. Master Mitchell consents, and Smith, who has years earlier lost his mother and father, look forward to a new environment, a temporary respite from milking calves and his other domestic chores in the master's great house. Smith will soon learn, though, that his culinary responsibilities involve much more than food preparation. In addition to choosing the young slave to feed his physical hunger, the captain also has chosen Smith to fulfill other despotic hungers. One morning, after the ship has docked in Richmond, Virginia, the captain and a shipmate go to town. The captain leaves Smith with orders to prepare his breakfast and have it ready upon his return. It is ice cold and raining fiercely outside. Smith asks the captain if he can cook below deck, away from the exposure to the elements, and the captain denies this request. The captain forces Smith to cook the fish in the caboose, which Smith describes as a large black kettle set on the deck, all open to the weather, to make fire in, and supported by bricks to prevent it from burning the deck. Try as he might, Smith cannot raise a fire strong enough to fry the fish as the captain likes. He decides to poach the fish and afterwards pours them out into a dish and places them on the table, awaiting the captain's return. The captain returns from town drunk. Needless to say, the cold poached fish fills the captain with dissatisfaction and disgust. Anticipating the captain's response, Smith stood outside the captain's quarters and peeped through the cabin window to see what effect the breakfast would have upon him. The captain calls Smith to his side and demands an explanation. Smith tries to justify himself by telling the captain that the rain and wind cooled my pan so that I could not fry the fish, and that I had done the best I could. After hearing his explanation, the captain coolly and calmly directs Smith to remove all of his clothes and go stand on the deck in the freezing cold until he has finished his breakfast. The captain knows, even before leaving the ship, how difficult it will be to fry fish in the cold wind and rain. Even the most expert cook could not stand in the open air under such conditions and cook a fish, not to mention frying it to a well-done crisp. Smith is young, not yet a man. He is innocent. This is his first time living away from the plantation, and he is also physically disabled. Smith is perfect prey for this white man, who makes ritual out of abuse and takes pleasure in a young, terrified, trembling black man exposed in the freezing cold rain. This is not the first time that Smith will be commanded to strip, stand, or kneel as he waits for the captain to come and deliver punishment. The colder Smith becomes, ridiculed by some of his shipmates and pitied by others, the hotter and angrier the captain becomes in his quarters. It is not clear whether he eats the fish or throws it into the waste pile. We only know that the captain emerges from his cabin with the fierceness of his nature, roused. Just as the fish is cold and cool and coated by the rain, so too does Smith become cold and covered. The captain wants Smith to experience something of the cold disgust and dissatisfaction that he himself tastes in the rain-drenched fish. A man who teaches through example, the captain restages the cooking scene. He has Smith stand in the freezing cold, basting and turning in the stares of crew members. Rather than a spatula, the captain gathers in preparation for Smith's punishment the end of a rope, a phallic object in his hands. He waits in his cabin for the fires of his rage and desire to peak. Sex and good taste come together in the beating that is more of a stylized rape than a routine punishment. Smith describes the scene thusly. There I was, divested of my clothing. He turned his fierce, fiery eyes on me when he came on deck. and with a look of fierce decision on his face, for now all the fierceness of his nature was roused, he took a rope's end and applied it vigorously to my naked back. In Arna Woman, Female Slaves in the Plantation South, Deborah Gray White describes how semi-clad black women working in rice fields nurtured white men's notion of their promiscuity. Frederick Law Olmsted, a northern white architect and abolitionist sympathizer, referred to black women working in flooded fields with their skirts reefed up around their waist as clumsy, gross, and elephantine. He further described these women who were focused on the task at hand as sly, sensual, and shameless. White notes that the exposure of women's bodies during whippings had similar consequences. Christopher Nichols, an escaped slave living in Canada, remembered how his master laid a woman on a bench, threw her clothes over her head, and whipped her. Another refugee remembered that when his mother was whipped, she was stripped completely naked. They didn't care nothing about it. Let everybody look at them at it. Similarly, Henry Bibb reported a whipping where a woman's naked, quivering flesh was tied up and exposed to the public gaze of all. The captain responds to Smith as though he has intentionally prepared the unpalatable meal, as if he has committed a deliberate act of resistance, like a slave who has stolen a pig or one who has sneaked away from the plantation at night. Within the general tableau of plantation violence, Smith's punishment registers as elaborate and extreme. A master or overseer might chastise and beat a slave for such an indiscretion, but the master usually administered such a beating with the clothes partially removed. They usually removed his shirt to get at the back. The captain has Smith remove all of his clothes and stand out in the open where all of the male crew members can laugh and pity his nakedness. This gesture conveys the captain's sexual dominance over Smith, his familiarity with and mastery over every crevice and surface of his body. Similar to Olmsted, who watches the black women working semi-clad in the rice fields with their skirts reefed up to their thighs, the captain reads sexual allure, brutal teasing, and masochism into Smith's labor. Smith thwarts his hunger, according to the captain's logic, because he wants to feel the captain's bite and taste, be penetrated and warmed by his violent embrace. Of course, these desires begin and end in the captain's mind. His desire for Smith is an impersonal, as it is brutally painful and consuming. The captain leaves the ship unreasonable and disagreeable. Otherwise, he would have allowed Smith to cook below deck. He would have instructed other crew members to shield Smith from the rain and wind. In her discussion of rape and violence, White notes the connection between physical hunger and sexual brutality. She notes that the man who whipped Henry Bibb's wife was often heard to exclaim that he had rather paddle a female than eat when he was hungry. It seems the ship captain would also rather beat Smith than eat. Rather than have Smith prepare another portion of food, he thrust the fierceness of his nature into the black youth. Furthermore, he forces Smith to participate. He makes Smith strip down, tremble in anticipation, and bear up under the biting cold. Smith's participation, his shame and degradation, make the trembling, raised flesh that rises to meet the captain all the more appetizing to the touch, all the more delectable. A second horrid beating related by Smith also centers on eating and meal preparation. This time, after the captain has taken his meal, Smith serves him an after-breakfast pastry. The captain asks Smith why he has not made more tea. Smith replies, "I told him it was all out. He wanted to know why I did not make more tea. I told him I thought there was a plenty. It was as much as I generally made." The captain flies into a rage and challenges Smith
for daring to think. Again, he commands Smith to divest himself of all of his clothing and to go stand above deck naked awaiting his arrival. At this point in the narrative, we are given to understand that the challenge, the command to strip and wait, and the anticipation that ensues, are all part of a sex brutality ritual that the captain practices frequently. Every day, the captain finds reason to beat Smith. The Cat-O-Nine-Tails had no rest. A day seldom passed on which he could find no occasion for its use, recalls Smith. The captain cultivates an aesthetic appreciation for Smith's naked, quivering flesh. Smith notes that the captain had a deep love for the music of the Cat-O-Nine-Tails. His taste for his delectable black subject transcends regular appetite. His taste for this Negro is a cruel parallel to the foundation tenets of Eurocentric culture and civilization. One thinks of music, poetry, and the taking of an after-dinner dessert and leisurely sport. These are practices of affluence and leisure culture that are all learned and based in an intangible sense of good taste. M.F.K. Fisher, a scholar of Epicureanism, has developed a categorical list that explains the importance of and process of cultivating taste. A number of the items on her list are particularly relevant and help explain how the captain's cultivated taste for the Negro overlaps with and reinforces more traditional categories of Eurocentric taste. Fisher describes taste as that one of our senses which gives us the greatest joy, because it recurs of necessity at least once every day, and can be repeated without inconvenience two or three times in that space of hours. Four, because it can mingle with all the other pleasures and even console us for their absence. Five, because its sensations are at once more lasting than others and more subject to our will. And six, because finally, in eating, we experience a certain special and indefinable well-being, which arises from our instinctive realization that by the very act we perform, we are repairing our bodily losses and prolonging our lives. In Smith's brutalization, there is frequency, a compound combination of pleasures, an apparent lasting, aesthetic resonance that remains with the captain like music, and a sense of well-being that arises from some instinctual source. The Negro serves, in this context, as a symbol and hallmark of civilization, taking his place alongside musical appreciation, philosophy, and even the ability to reason. The ship captain chastises Smith for thinking, for daring to think, outside of his useful role of sexual object, delight, and masochistic morsel. French political philosopher Montesquieu observed, "It is impossible for us to assume that these people are men, because if we assume that they were men, one would begin to believe that we ourselves were not Christians." Montesquieu's comments reveal a correlation between European institution-making in the colonial context and the unmaking of the humanity of the African and black person. The captain's social stature and honorific role aboard the ship takes form and shape from Smith's denied humanity, the denial of Smith's innate abilities to think and reason. When the captain finally arrives after finishing his breakfast and tea, he puts Smith down on his knees in a position more blatantly sexualized than the first one Smith relates. "When he did come, he put my head between his legs, and while I was in this position, I thought my last days had come. I thought while he was using the Cat-O-Nine-Tails to my naked back and hearing the whizzing of the rope that if ever I got away, I would throw myself overboard and put an end to my life." The captain places Smith between his legs in a position simulating an animal on all fours. He positions Smith's head below his genital region and gives himself ample access to Smith's back and buttocks. Holding Smith in this manner between his legs, the captain beats him almost into unconsciousness. Smith feels that he wants to die. The captain punished me so much that I was tired of life. He jumps overboard and almost drowns. The captain relishes Smith's struggles between life and death. Reaching up for help, Smith sees the captain. He sat perfectly at ease, or composed on the deck looking at me, but making no effort to help me. This, finally, is the prize and revelation. The peril of Smith's soul and the tormenting of his spirit feed the captain. A parasite, the captain feeds upon the terror and loss of self Smith experiences. Only because Smith is his host, a vital source of his manhood, livelihood, and honor, does the captain finally draw the young black man up to the surface. This scene calls to mind a similar one relayed by Oluada Equiano. Equiano describes a master who, after punishing his slaves, would then have them get into a long wooden box or case he had for that purpose, in which he shut them up during his pleasure. It was just about the height and breadth of a man, and the poor wretches had no room when in the case to move. This master placed his slaves in a coffin. This type of punishment, like that which Smith undergoes, the master used to emphasize the slave's socially dead status. It was a method of emptying out and making the person into an instrumentum vocal, perfectly flexible, unattached, and deraciate. In this way, the master reinforced for himself and to all members of the community that the slave existed only through the parasite holder, who was called the master. On this intersubjective level, the slaveholder fed on the slave to gain the very direct satisfactions of power over another, honor enhancement, and authority. Smith makes the captain a man, rather than the captain's making him the same. When the captain first leases the young boy from the plantation, he tells him that he intends to make him into a sailor and a man. In truth, Smith is a type of food source to the captain's white masculinity. The captain reinforces Smith's infantile state by stripping him down, parading him before crew members, and not allowing him to express an intelligible thought. Domination of the black youth ensures the captain's supremacy. Smith, we can say with certainty, undergoes a change through this process of the captain's making him into a slave. A slave being the opposite of a freedom-possessed man. A slave being, in a Hegelian sense, a sycophantic personality that takes identity from the deific power of the master. All of this, to a great extent, we know or have seen analyzed. But what does it mean to alter the Hegelian dialectic, for the slave to be a type of food and the master a cannibalistic social agent? Stretching the dialectic even further, what does it mean when the nature of the consciousness that exists for itself is consumption, human consumption, on the levels of sex, psyche, and soul? These questions take on greater significance and importance when addressed to members of the ruling Southern aristocracy. Importantly, the captain was cruel and hungry, but he was also a middleman on the human food chain. The more refined Epicurean appetite for the Negro's body and person existed among the ruling class, among the slave owners and their progeny. Edward A. Pollard was a white journalist from Virginia who was raised on a plantation. Pollard, a defender of slavery, declared the Southern Negro the most lovable of creatures in his place. In Black Diamonds, he writes to a friend of returning to Virginia after traveling all over the world. I have seen the hidden, hideous slavery of Asia. I have seen the coolies of China housed on the wild sea with wilder usages, or creeping with dejected faces in the suicide houses of Canton.
I have seen the Siamese slave creeping in the presence of his master on all fours, a human quadrupled. Pollard is addressing C, a northern acquaintance who was presumably awaiting enlightenment on the true condition of the Negro slave. Pollard tells Mr. C that after all this traveling, he looks forward to getting back to the southern institution, to the evidences of comfort and happiness on the plantations of the South. And to better illustrate the comfort and happiness that he imagines, Pollard presents C with the image of an unadulterated Negro serving on the train car that is taking him back to the South. In poetic and emotionally compelling imagery, he writes about the black man. He looked like home. I could have embraced the old uncle, but was afraid the passengers from such a demonstration might mistake me for an abolitionist. I looked at him with my face aglow and my eyelids touched with tears. How he reminded me of my home, of days gone by, that poetry of youth. Another Southerner, Basil Lanu Gildersleeve, thinking back to slavery before emancipation, wrote that the poetry of life will still find its home in the old order. This idea of slavery and the bonded Negro as poetic cultivation profoundly shaped the imagination of Southern slave owners. For Pollard, the Negro serves as an emblem of home. He is a signpost of sorts, a marker of affections, beauty, nobility, and the innocence that the white Southerner associates with his childhood. The Negro is also a separating line between comforting, familiarity, and the danger, uncertainty, and fatigue that foreign environments inspire. Pollard compares this Negro man to the warm, wide hills of my sweet home. This is not simply a Negro man which he speaks, but rather a delectable thing, a personal familiar, an acquired taste and set of sensibilities. The Negro is as natural and permanent as the landscape, as aesthetically pleasing and necessary to the cultured citizen as poetry. The Negro is the institution of family and home, and simultaneously an evaporative nothing, a non-entity to this Southern white gentleman who might just as soon lynch his object of affection were the black man to step outside his place. For the Negro, this was dangerous territory indeed. It is as if whites brought to bear upon the Negro's person generations of European cultivation and institution building. Like poetry, a learned art and acquired taste, the taste and hunger for the Negro was learned, rooted in repetition and practice. The Negro that Pollard speaks of was a familiar home territory, a safe space in and through which white men could feel, play, lust, rage, and finally make themselves at home. This type of Negro whites naturalized and romanticized, much as they romanticized the natural landscape of the Americas after seizing it from murdered and systematically contained Native Americans. Booker T. Washington poignantly experienced this institutionalization of the Negro, and he documented it in Up From Slavery, an autobiography. In 1879, on a stopover visit in the nation's capital, Washington witnessed the town go into a fervor over a dark-skinned man checking in to a white hotel. The town intended to lynch the man until they found that he was from Morocco, and therefore not an American Negro. In another instance that took place that same year, Washington was transporting a Native American youth who had a similar complexion to his own to Washington. Aboard the train, a diner server informed Washington that the Native youth could enter the dining car, but that he, a Negro of the same complexion, could not. In both the hotel and aboard the train car, we see the Negro serving as a utilitarian object that helped define social places, determine the interior and exterior margins of society, and mark the boundary between domestic and international terrains. The Moroccan man and the American Negro have the same hair texture, skin color, and phenotypic features. The only difference between the two men is a process of cultivation and domestication rooted in white tastes, comforts, habits, perceptions, and social needs. During and beyond slavery, blacks have associated the type of Negro pallor described with femininity, but more specifically with a nurturing, maternal male role. Trudair Harris describes a black man who plays a nurturing role as grandmotherly. Analyzing the issue more deeply, she notes that this grandmotherly type black man approaches the mammy figure in the extent of his concern for the white person who is in his care. This primary goal is to soothe the precious child whose welfare rests in his hands. To comfort the child, the grandmother must show him that the danger which threatened him is no longer real because grandmother has control over the boogeyman. The black man plays this role for Pollard, who wants to hold him, be held by him, and feel a returned sense of safety within domestic shores after having traveled throughout the strange and unsafe world. The black male grandmother type figure reproduces the national identification, an internal and external sense of geography of the white male. This he or she figure also reproduces the white male father, white male child as father, master, owner, and kind paternal family member. Like the difference between wild and domesticated game, the more appetizing Negro was one whom whites had domesticated, made into a type of pet whom they could work, romanticize, brutalize, or socially consume. Ex-slave Jim Allen, speaking to a WPA interviewer, admitted that he was his master's pet. "Did we have good eating? Yes, ma'am. Old master fed so good. If I was his pet, he never allowed no one to pester me neither. As I do told you, I was Mars Allen's pet nigger boy. I was called a stray. I slept on the floor by old Miss and Mars Bob." Another man named Pet Franks was given this name by his master. His master and the master's family conditioned him to be their domesticated object on the plantation. Interviewed years after slavery, he revealed, "I knows all about slavery and the war. I was right there on the spot where it all happened. I wish to goodness I was back there now. Not in the war, but in slavery times. I do remember hearing about slaves on other places getting whipped sometimes. I guess niggas like that wish they was free. But I didn't want to leave my white folks, ever." Allen and Franks reinforced plantation white's sense of themselves as moral and benevolent. They deify their masters and whiteness in general and learn to participate in their consumption into the Southern plantation body politic.
That will do it for this week. We did not quite get to the end of Chapter 2, but we are close. We'll pick up the subheading. We're almost at the part where they're talking about the taste of Nat Turner. That'll be the end of Chapter 2. We'll pick up there next Friday for session number 4. Folks have comments they would like to share. The number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to participate. Any commentary folks have from the second audio segment, or folks have nothing to say? I think I did hear Emmy, but your volume is pretty low. I heard Thomas, Mr. Demi Four as well.
Is this better?
Much better.
Okay. It's this part was more trying than the last part. So it took me a little while and was trying to gather my thoughts. But I will say that this book, and particularly this part, illuminates why our oppression is drastically different than other non-white people's oppression, and why we get to spend considerable time dissecting it, why it's different, how it's different, and what it's done to us. And I mean, I really don't even know how to feel at the moment about what I heard for that. That was like the first, you know, the entire thing. You know, I know people, you know, we were beat so bad we'd want to die, but to be so humiliated over and over and over again, to be the part where he had to get on all fours and put his head between his legs and get beaten. I mean, you know, I really don't even know what to say. I don't even know what to say, except that I know whatever record we have is but it's like the tip of the iceberg of what went down in all of these situations where we are subjugated and underneath these white people. And I mean, if there was ever a reason, like a lot of people try to act like it just ended and it was done and it was what it was, moving on, but that's not true. Like, psychology, it feeds into the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. So like, to where the sexuality of, you know, in mass is warped, and like, whoa, all of a sudden the whole vampire thing makes way more sense than ever. Even the bit about me after whipping them, then putting them in a coffin or something like a coffin. I mean, and I really, like, to me, it's also a little bit kind of slightly terrifying, because the only thing that keeps them at bay is some type of like legislation or a sense of law or something like that. But I feel like should that ever disappear, they will return with a vengeance to do all that they've ever done and been waiting for to do for the last like 100 years. They're just like seething with anticipation to do it, and just let there be something like a purge, you know. And so anywho, and then my heart, I will say this, that, you know, as a black female, I know that there are differences between males and females that get to be recognized. And if that were not true, white men would not have been targeting black males and continue to target black males at the way that they do. So putting that in a perspective as a black female, and knowing that no matter what, whether the black male had his father around or didn't have his father around, and maybe what that father had to go through, and all of the abstractions of this kind of sexual consumption or degradation or humiliation, whether in the workplace or on the street or anywhere you go, that being translated from generation to generation, and how the men are struggling to find their own identity and in a situation with no power. And then, like, if white men were like that before, they're still like that. So that means I wouldn't know it because I'm not a black male. But black males, like, every time they go to the bathroom and there's a white male next to them in the stall, with the way that that's set up, or the locker room, or black baby, like black boy babies, and like, you know, that kind of thing. So, okay, I'm good. Thank you.
Did the caller 7722, did you get to share before, or have you not been able to comment yet this evening?
No, I haven't. I haven't commented yet this evening.
Oh, you should proceed.
Yes, thank you. Greetings to the listeners and the host. I was the previous caller. I had very similar thoughts to that, specifically the passage on page 84 when he actually throws himself overboard. a feeling of physical disgust came over me. The young man throws himself overboard, wanting to end his life. And this Mr. Smith, this cruel, inhumane, demon white man, watches him and takes so much pleasure out of seeing him die, but realizes that I still need you. I still want to toy with you. I mean, we people in the world we live in enjoy these, what they call entertainment, and they love to watch what some would call horror movies. But I can't think of any horror movie that could equal to what the black man, the black woman, the black child has had to endure throughout the system of racism, white supremacy until today. Again, that's how we know that white people kill for fun. It's a game for them. And like the previous caller said, you see the modern day parallel. Because like, what do you think happens? You think all of a sudden, like the next, like this, you know, this young man had a family, and all of a sudden his children are just normal. Like, what do we think these emotions went? What do we think this terrorism went? You think Mr. Smith just had children, and his children were just, oh, I love black, and just hugging and kissing black women, and you think that? I mean, is that what we really feel? These feelings haven't went anywhere. I think Joy DeGruy has a lot of information on that. But now I know why I feel certain ways about white people. And when I learn about white supremacy and its effects, it makes so much more sense. Again, getting back to Neely Fuller, if you don't understand white supremacy, everything you think you understand will just confuse you. This is exhibit number one. In a lot of aspects as far as the sexual confusion. But not only that, just why we are the way we are as a conditioned people. Also, I thought it was interesting, the last comments there made by one of the formerly enslaved persons, I don't know if Alan or Franks, he said, you know, he had it good, so he didn't want to be free. And the same mentality. And that's why when people say it really makes me question on whether, you know, the previous caller was saying how terrifying it was. And the only thing keeping them from doing that is this supposed legislation. But the reality to me, it makes me really question whether these people have changed at all, because there's no evidence of that. They still participate in these same behaviors on a daily basis. And to me, as a non-white black victim of white supremacy, this to me is just reinforces why we have to bring it into the system. And taking time to read these passages is something maybe not a lot of non-white people don't want to do, but it's so worth the time to get this understanding, especially when our brothers and sisters have this same mentality as we did during this quote-unquote, you know, terrible period, that is still continuing today. I'll take my call offline. Thank you.
Mr. Demray Four, you were going to comment, sir?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I, too, this last reading was, nauseating. Especially the part about when in the seasoning, the results of it, when the slave was saying that he slept on the floor next to his master and all that, that, you know, had an impact on me. This whole thing about seasoning brought up another thought that there were probably thousands of ways that these white slave masters and these terrorists, you know, did black people, because I read somewhere, and I don't know if it's true, someone else has heard, but they had a form of what they call buck breaking, which was, I guess you could put that under seasoning, you know, where they would humiliate black men in front of their families and their kids, you know. But, you know, it's just so vast, you know, that the ways that they would use to humiliate and control black people till, like sex forms, you know, I heard about that. It's just stimulating a lot of things that you can research and find out about. But, you know, just when you think you've heard it all, it's always something just even worse and more horrendous than what you even conceived before. I'll mute my line on that. Thanks, guys.
Hello? Yes, sir.
Yes, I agree with each of the last two callers. You know, their crimes of against humanity are irredeemable. You know, the section before we got into the second part that Roz read, we read, it said it was like an unwritten contract amongst white. When they were talking about when they decided to eat the black males. And I think that unwritten contract, we could just call the system of racism, white supremacy. They all practicing it. It's just an unwritten contract amongst whites. Yeah, this is as horrendous these stories are. It kind of looking into the future or looking into right now explains some of the things we see us doing to each other. You know, it's really sad. And, you know, it's just a system of racism, white supremacy. Just, I think that in this way, the context, the way he's writing this, explaining the system, at least, you know, that's what I think he's doing. He's just laying out, you know, just different aspects of the system, but through the area of sex and through, I guess, man, he doesn't have an area for cannibalism. But I just think it's just really brilliant. I've never thought of it this way. And also, I just want to say, man, I think that the modern day cannibalism is organs and blood have a huge consumption of young black males shooting each other down and getting real young organs to be donated to these older white people. This is why they live so long. I mean, the Bushes are still alive. The Queen is still alive. Like, how is this? I mean, black people aren't living that long. I believe that they're harvesting us and taking out organs and blood. And that's what's feeding them. And I mean, all I'm thinking.
The art.
Yes, sir.
Greetings. Yeah, the second audio session was very hard to stomach. For time's sake, I will just share one portion that stood out. Who just about had to beat somebody every day to satisfy his craving. He had a big bullwhip, and he stake a nigger on the ground and make another nigger hold his head down with his mouth in the dirt and whip the nigger till blood run out and red up the ground. Historians of slavery have typically described such acts as cruel and unnecessary forms of punishment. Yet the descriptors cruel, unusual, and punishment do not adequately define the craving, the institutionalized hunger that often characterized the master's relationship to his slaves, and more specifically, to his male slaves. Yeah, the consumption of black males very quickly. I go to school right next to where the Milwaukee Bucks play their basketball games, and you just see lots of white men going to see these black guys. And Gus, I don't remember exactly what program it was, but I remember specifically it was either a writer and or a journalist who said that he could not either ejaculate and or have sex with his wife until he thought about Charles Barkley nude or something like that. And I mute my line. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. That was the white guy out here. I could, if you called me on it, I could get his name. It was the end of 2013. He was on the broadcast. He's a professor at the University of Washington. He wrote a book about the Seattle Supersonics. Now they're the Oklahoma City Thunder, but he followed them for a whole season, and he had a graphic passage about, yeah, he couldn't perform sexually, or he enhanced his sexuality by thinking about these black basketball players. Anybody that has not been able
can
to...
I hear?
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you guys for taking my call. Just to piggyback off of Thomas in New York, and I think it was the one or two callers before him, and I think it was maybe at the end of the last session where they were discussing harvesting and the harvesting of our organs, and Thomas was discussing that not too long ago. And it made me think of the TV show V, when they actually, like, the humans started to find out that they were basically harvesting human beings for them to eat because they were actually reptilians that looked like humans. It just brought that whole idea of harvesting us in a holistic way like that, just reading these passages. And Thomas, last segment, brought up a question of whether or not black flesh actually tastes better as far as being the reasoning why white people do cannibalize us. And one thing that I've learned is that, this through my research, is that when people die, or even animals die in a violent manner, they have a rush of adrenaline that floods their organs and their entire body system as a reaction to whatever suffering they're going through. And from what I understand, that's what white people like. That's the seasoning. And it's that adrenaline is almost has like a drug-like effect on them. And that's one of the reasons they enjoy cannibalizing us, because of that adrenaline. And I think melanin, I would add that too. excuse me, just to get to the text, there was a section briefly that was written on page 80 where they say, it is not clear whether he eats the fish or throws it into the waste pile. We only know that the captain emerges from the cabin with the fierceness of his nature roused. And it made me think that the author being a homosexual male, quote-unquote homosexual male, I think his writing really lends force to the understanding of the text, because, like I said, I think he was also consumed in that manner too. So that's why I think he writes so incredibly descriptive in his depictions of certain things. And when he wrote about the fierceness of his nature being roused, that was such a sexualized term, because the term nature would refer to a male's penis. And of course, he's referring to his rage, but it's also in concert with the idea of his sexual nature being aroused as he's basically raping this guy, this black male victim, via his slave status and his ability to abuse him as his slave. So I just found that to be very poignant, and I do agree that the text was very hard to get through in certain sections. He says, another southerner, Basil Lanoue Gildersleeve, thinking back to slavery before emancipation, wrote that the poetry of life will still find its home in the old order. That this idea of slavery and the bonded Negro as poetic cultivation profoundly shaped the imagination of Southern slave owners. For Pollard, the Negro serves as an emblem of home. He is a signpost of sorts, a marker of affections, beauty, nobility, and the innocence that the white Southerner associates with his childhood. The Negro is also a separating line between comforting familiarity and the danger, uncertainty, and fatigue that foreign environments inspire. Pollard compares the Negro man to the warm, wide hills of my sweet home. is simply not a Negro man of which he speaks, but rather a delectable thing, a personal familiar and permanent as the landscape, as aesthetically pleasing and necessary to the cultured citizen as poetry. The Negro is the institution of family and home and simultaneously an evaporative nothing, a non-entity to this Southern white gentleman who might just as soon lynch his object of affection were the black man to step outside of his place. And I just find that so, like, sick, just the psychopathology of the way white people view us. And it's always in the context of white supremacy. There's nothing that they find more normalcy and comfort in rather than the abuse and just terrorism of black people. And we really have to take this seriously when we study them and when we interact with them to really change the way we function with them due to the fact that they function in this manner, because you can't get more predatory than these people. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Grand. I'll share a few thoughts. I'll see if I can go quickly and save maybe a last minute if somebody has a final thought that they want to get in. He included a reference to LeVron Bennett Jr. describing the seasoning, breaking process for enslaved black people. Legendary black journalist. He also wrote Forced into Glory, a biography on white enslaver Abraham Lincoln and characterizing him as a racist. In tremendous detail, definitely a book I would recommend. I think that's in my top 10, Forced into Glory, LeVron Bennett Jr. I thought it was really important as well, a form of punishment, being hanging black people in the smokehouse. I had not heard that before. Really important, again, conveying a lot of, you know, what the thrust of this text is about, the consumption and cannibalism, white cannibalism of black bodies. Next, let's see. I think Robin Wisconsin already touched on it. It was really significant, him pointing out that describing this as cruel and unusual doesn't accurately capture when someone has a craving, an appetite for terrorizing and abusing black people, which white people collectively clearly have demonstrated a dedication, a devotion to. I thought that was great that he pointed that out. I thought it was really important as well, the passage where it reads, Smith is perfect prey for this white man who makes ritual out of abuse and takes pleasure in a young, terrified, trembling black man exposed to the freezing cold rain. This is not the first time that Smith will be commanded to strip, stand, or kneel as he waits for the captain to come and deliver punishment. I was just, again, showing this craving for abusing black people, but it reminded me the report that we just heard of people who listened to the compensatory call-in in Rikers Island, where black females that were coming to visit inmates, where they were forced to strip or undergo these really invasive cavity searches and might have to take their sanitary pads off, and I mean just extreme humiliation to make these visits. It reminded me of that, and also the report Nick Childs authored about Nuts to Butts in Illinois State Penitentiary, where they would have black male inmates strip nude and be so close to each other that one black male's genitals would be touching the rectum of the black male that they were standing behind, that this was a ritual 21st century practice, same type of thing, showing that total domination over the body of black people. Let's see. Same passage again, where he says in her discussion of rape and violence, White notes the connection between physical hunger and sexual brutality. She notes that the man who whipped Henry Bibb's wife was often heard to exclaim that he had rather paddle a female than eat when he was hungry. That, again, when Mr. Fuller says the number one motivating force in the known universe, white people practicing racism, white supremacy. And again, where he used the term ritual, where he says he describes all this as being a part of a sex brutality ritual that the captain practices frequently, beating this young black male. And I think that there are probably lots of sex brutality rituals within the system of racism, white supremacy. I am sure there are tons of them operating in the school system that we just don't know about or just don't get publicized. Let's see, I stood out here towards the end of chapter 2. I thought it was really good when he broke down some of the reasons why we have such a strong association with taste. He says the final reason being because finally in eating we experience a certain special and indefinable well-being which arises from our instinctive realization that by the very act we perform, we are repairing our bodily losses and prolonging our lives. I think that right there is the exact way individuals who classify themselves as white look at the practice of terrorizing, dominating, consuming black people. They are repairing their genetic deficiencies, prolonging their lives, the system of racism, white supremacy, by dominating and terrorizing Negroes. I think that's the exact way that they look at all of this. When the portion where it mentions the ship captain chastises Smith for thinking, for daring to think outside the useful role of sexual object delight and masochistic morsel, reminded me a lot of Dr. Welsing, where she says the slave is not to reason why. That's our role. You're not supposed to think. You're just Negro for whatever my pleasure, whatever my appetite is for that particular day, that particular moment. Last thing I'll get in, see if we have that 60 seconds. I thought it was really important as well where she describes where the captain enjoys having Smith in this state of terror. I think Roz talked about that as well with cannibalism, almost out for the hunt, to have the animal, the Negro, being chased, stalked, to have them in a state of fear. I think they do that same sort of thing all the time in the system of racism, white supremacy, but that being picked out explicitly, I thought was really important in this chapter. And then I thought she, Mr. Woodard, answered the question that was raised before about do whites, do they just keep us around to be mistreated, or why do they keep us around, where she says Smith is a type of food source to the captain's white masculinity. The captain reinforces Smith's infantile state by stripping him down and parading him before crew members and not allowing him to express an intelligible thought. Domination of the black youth ensures the captain's supremacy. It's not eradication, extermination, or termination of the black youth. It's domination. I need you to be here so that I can dominate and consume you. That supports my supremacy as a white man, white woman, white child. I think I can end there. Does anybody have something they can get in like 30 seconds before we wrap up?
I did. One thing was where you brought up the idea of us, the slaves and us as a hindsight thought, not being able to think. That leads again to how this system makes us stupid. We're not supposed to think and function as thinking beings. And then the whole idea of the captain waiting and making the slave anticipate his beating brought me to something that used to happen to me. That happened to me a few times in my childhood where my mother would do that. I would know I was going to get a beating and she would make me wait. And I would just be terrified in anticipation. And I put those two together to say, hey, my parents learned that from white people. Thank you. And I mute my line.
For sure. We will pick things up next week. We're right at the end of chapter 2. Probably should have finished that today. That was my fault, just not getting in the last little bit. But we'll finish up chapter 2 next week. Continue. Hopefully we'll get all the way through chapter 3 as well. If you have commentary. Oh, man, I forgot. We had Joy. She was listening. She had commentary about last week's segment. I just forgot to include it. I will include that next week. And anybody else, if you have commentary that you want to share, we have, you know, several sessions to go, so we have ample time. If you want to share, if you listen to the archives and want to include your commentary, just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and we will include your commentary or observations as we go. If you have questions as well, we can pose those, and we'll have ample time for people to answer as we proceed. We'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We will review the last 7 days on the plantation, Black History Month. Folks have any observations or thoughts, counter-racist suggestions, we'll be looking forward to sharing tomorrow, again, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in this evening. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. I will state again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Even though it's the weekend, I know folks are probably going out and have your fun, do whatever you do, but you certainly want to remain codified. You do not want to be under the influence and have that be the time that you bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any other race soldier, badge or no. Whites are dangerous predators looking for an opportunity to abuse, consume a Negro. I don't think being under the influence of tobacco, alcohol, cannabis, any other narcotics, I don't think that's going to aid us in neutralizing racist man, racist woman, racist child. The evidence certainly does not suggest that at this point. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.